Things are getting a bit spicy up in France. Over 100,000 people were protesting in the streets. Many of them were rioting. A vaccination center was set on fire and several others were vandalized because Emmanuel Macron has introduced a law that if you cannot prove you are vaccinated, you will get up to 6 months in prison. If you run an establishment open to the public and you do not have, if you are not checking people, if they're vaccinated, you will get up to a year in prison. Well, naturally, people are not happy with this. And I talked about this earlier on my other channel, but this is, well, COVID cases are on the rise basically everywhere. People are scared of the Delta variant, and now we're seeing draconian measures like in France. Over in Australia, we're getting mixed signals, I suppose. Katie Hopkins has been deported because apparently she broke quarantine or something like that. And a bunch of other celebrities have come in and been given special leeway and special access. But I'm not super concerned necessarily about the double standard at this point because we know that exists. I suppose I'm more concerned about with whether or not the rise in COVID cases, the Delta variant, is going to result in more lockdowns, which Joe Biden says, well, it's not off the table. So we'll talk about this, and we're going to talk a lot about, I guess, why we don't like cities. And we're being joined by a homesteader and author, Travis Corcoran. Do you want to introduce yourself real quick?
Sure. Thanks, Tim. So I am a homesteader and I am an author. My day job is, 50 hours a week as a software engineer. Homesteading is something that, on the one hand, I do on the weekends. That's when I'm out fixing the tractor and planting the pumpkins and butchering the pigs and all that sort of stuff. But it also impacts one's entire life sort of Monday through Friday in that, my wife and I talk a lot about how we really love the fact that, 50% of our food comes right off of the farm and every morning the bacon is from our pigs.
Can you pull your mic up a little bit? Sorry.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Sorry. And, the eggs are from there and, when we make whatever, even tacos, that's, coming from, beef that I've processed. And then there's also a lot of resiliency to living on a homestead, which ties into the whole COVID thing. And, I'm here to some degree to talk about some books that I've written, Escape the City, Volumes 1 and 2. And the timing was perfect on this because when COVID hit, a whole lot of people in the cities, their lifestyles just, turned terrible. And there's obviously the whole real estate realignment that's going on right now where real estate prices are absolutely crashing in every city core. And you're seeing, huge price run-ups in other places as, half the country redistributes where it wants to live.
They're fleeing the city.
Right, yeah. Well,
it's good to hear that they're taking Jack Posobiec's advice and my advice.
Right.
And absolutely. Your advice. Escape the city.
Hopefully. The Kickstarter did well, and the book's now up on Amazon, so the advice is there for anyone who wants it.
We're going to talk a lot about what's going on with this lockdown stuff. I mean, this stuff in France is absolutely draconian, but then an optimistic solution. Because I've been saying this a long time. Like I actually was saying this today. It's so amazing. I'm looking out my window when I'm recording these videos. Forest. Mm-hmm. There's like deer running around. They're doing deer stuff, and then I see them like going for the pawpaw, and I'm like getting nervous. Like, ooh, they're gonna take it. But apparently, it's we have to worry because they're not ripe yet, so the deer won't go near them. But I just gotta make sure we get them before the deer take them. But it's a lot of fun. So we'll talk about this stuff. Ian's chilling.
Yeah, I was out in the woods over the weekend. I think it was over the weekend picking some wine berries, and man, I was getting scratched up by the brambles, getting my hair caught in the twigs, and it felt great. I felt alive. I felt connected with nature. I felt like it was enhancing my immune system by giving me just a little bit of those cuts. A little bit of that dirt.
As long as you wash it off.
And then I went and took a shower.
There you go.
I feel like $1 million. Ian Cross. In the house. What up, everybody?
Yeah. And I am also here. I did not go out and find wine berries, but I'm really excited to try this wine once it's done. I'm really curious what it tastes like.
Wine. So wine berries are a local, they're not local. They're an invasive Asian variant of raspberries, and they're everywhere in Appalachia. So you drive down the road, and you see red berries everywhere. They're amazing.
They're great.
Pop them right off. And so we're going to make a little bit of wine.
I'm super excited.
Yeah, you have better invasive species here in the Maryland, D.C. area than we have up in New Hampshire. We've got Japanese knotweed and bittersweet. And I am out there, every weekend with a pick and shovel digging that stuff up and getting rid of it.
At first, we have stink bugs, too. Mm-hmm. And they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. They're insane. And at first, I was upset about it. Then we got chickens. Now it's like, ooh, a stink bug. Like food for the chickens.
Yeah.
And they love the little things, man. So we'll get into all that stuff, but we're going to start dark and then move into the more optimistic. Before we do, head over to timcast.com, my friends. We have a very brand new website that is finally up. Actually went up on Saturday. That surprised me. I was like, it's going to be Monday, but it'll probably be late. And it goes up on Saturday. Obviously there are some bugs. We're launching. It is now the official beta because we're in alpha. So you may encounter some bugs, but trust me, we are working around the clock to make sure it works properly. We got the brand new news section. Tons of articles are going up. We're doing we have a lot of news being published. We're going to be hiring more people. As a member, you'll get access to the members only segment. We'll have a bonus members only podcast coming up after the show goes up around 11 or so p.m. So make sure you sign up and don't forget to like this video, subscribe to this channel, hit that notification bell, even though it probably doesn't do anything, and share the show with your friends. It's the most important thing. Instead of us spending all this money on marketing, which we don't have, like, you know, CNN puts up billboards and buys airtime in airports, of which I guess they don't do anymore, we just rely on word of mouth. So with your support, thank you very much. Go to TimCast.com. Now, let's read this first story and talk about what's going on. We got this from TimCast.com.
Ooh.
Australia sends mixed signals on who is permitted to enter the country, deports Katie Hopkins. They say despite permitting the arrival of celebrities, come on, TimCast, get a copy editor, the government has not brought home 40,000 Australians. Now, the article basically goes on to mention that there are many celebrities flying in, like, you know, you've got what they say Nicole Kidman flew in. You have Lachlan Murdoch and Keith Urban were among the elite group who have been allowed to travel back to the country via private plane. They were also permitted to quarantine at their private homes. They go on to mention that, British commentator Katie Hopkins, who was also in Australia to film Big Brother, was deported for comments she made online about breaking the country's quarantine regulations. So we've seen a lot of this lockdown stuff going on. And now basically the story is Australia is prolonging its COVID-19 lockdown in Victoria amid the Delta outbreak. So this is the excuse by which they're saying everyone's got to quarantine again if you're flying into the country. And it kind of, I got to say, it is awfully convenient. If you are a proponent of the Great Reset, are you familiar with the Great Reset?
Oh, absolutely.
It's awfully fortuitous, I suppose, for those who are fans of the Great Reset and those who have advocated for it, that we can't travel to places anymore, that people are deported if they, you know, they break quarantine. I get it. The country has laws. Australia's allowed to deport who they want, I suppose. But now they're prolonging this. Now there's fears of you know, the Delta variant outbreak. And I'm just, you know, I'm curious. You mentioned in the intro, we're talking about people fleeing these cities. Mm-hmm. What's your prediction on where we go?
Sure. You know, I've got some thoughts about the current month and the current year, but we were talking before the show rolled about, you know, I think the world is changing in a really fundamental and big way, and the kind of thing that you don't see every year. I mean, sure, things change, you know, one year and the next. But, you know, I think that every 500 years or so, things really, really change. And we saw that, you know, around 500 years ago with the invention of the printing press, which led to the rise of Protestantism and religious wars, and then eventually the Westphalian nation states coming up and replacing feudalism. And, you know, I think the internet and the new modes of communication technology right now are, you know, and this isn't a story from like last year or 2 years. It's, you know, the 30 years, 50 years. But the world is really changing fundamentally, and I think we're going to see changes at about the same scale. So I think that people are escaping the cities right now, and that's going to accelerate over the coming years. But that's just one component of a much bigger change in currency and lifestyles and economies and how, you know, states and people are organized on the planet.
Do you think it's intentional? Like there are people who are actively trying to kill off cities?
Obviously, well, you know, there's intention out there and there's emergent stuff. I don't think that the elites who are pushing the Great Reset and the whole, you know, live in the pod, eat the bugs, want people to escape the cities. You know, they're saying, hey, you know, our system is already 80% along and we just need to tune it a little more. We need, you know, more green energy, even though windmills are sort of a terrible technology and nuclear is much better. And we need more sustainable foods. And by sustainable, they're always talking about bugs, and never about, you know, raising pigs and chickens and, you know, eating wine berries.
No, they're saying not to eat pigs and chickens.
Right.
They're saying to eat the bugs.
Right.
Did you see that story out of Leesburg, Virginia, where the guy was serving cicadas?
I did not.
He was like going into his his side of his house and picking them off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I guess the health department was like, dude, you can't pick bugs off the side of your house and serve it to people.
Uh-huh.
So he ordered cicadas.
Right.
And now I'm like, I guess they were from China.
Huh.
So it clearly defeats the purpose of eating sustainable bugs from the floor.
Ship them in by air or something.
Yeah,
perhaps.
Right. Just eat the centipedes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, sorry, I don't know.
Oh, I think your question was this intentional to get people to flee the cities? And I think what's intentional is the Great Reset, the whole endless propaganda about how eating bugs and your lifestyle is going to be different and you're not going to own anything, you're going to rent everything. And, you know, I think that a lot of that is intentional. But I think that we're, to some degree, seeing the last gasp of the current system, sort of like, you know, the Soviets around 1985. The current elites have run out of any energy. I mean, the Soviets motivated their people. You know, it was a terrible system, but there was actual grassroots enthusiasm. When you bring rural electrification to people, you know, they're going to like that, even if you're doing other terrible things. When you educate the sons of dirt farmers, they're going to like that. And so the Soviets had some innate momentum for decades, and then eventually they just played out everything they could do. And then, you know, they're talking about the 18th five-year plan in, you know, 1986 or something, and everyone knew it was a joke. And the Soviets in the system said, you know, they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work. And I think that, you know, the last bastion of centrally planned communism is, you know, here in the West.
What is that? I mean,
I'm joking a little bit and making a reference to sort of Mencius Moldbug, Curtis Yarvin stuff.
But you mean to say like the current system we're under, everybody knows it's a joke. And I think
exactly. And that's where I was going.
You're right.
Right. We've got, and don't worry, I know what one can say and not say, but we've got a Democratic Party. The Republican Party ceased to be able to put forward any candidates of its own sort of ideology, and the Democratic Party has sort of entirely run out of steam, where they're putting forward these candidates who it's inevitable because it's their time, and you get these, you know, sort of absolute laughing stocks.
Hillary Clinton.
Right, right. Joe Biden, God help him, does not seem to have all of his marbles in one place.
He's got like two marbles left.
Right, right. You know, and it's a tragedy. But this is the last gasp of the system, you know. And so they pretend to have a president, and, you know, we pretend to respect the system. And I think that things are changing.
I like that joke. You know, they pretend to pay us, we pretend to work, they pretend to have a president. I think the sad thing is, yeah, it's paper thin.
Yeah.
You know, there is a presidential administration.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Biden is fumbling, bumbling Joe, Trinidad on shop at a pressure, bad at cath care. And, you know, one thing that I've brought up on the show frequently is that when he speaks, it's very obvious he's not talking to half the country.
Right.
When he makes references to COVID, when he makes references to law, they've basically cut off in terms of there was a point where they were like, you know, we want to try and make sure we're getting to the other side to win those votes. Now they're like, we don't even care.
Yeah.
We don't care about those
votes.
We saw
in the 1900s, 20th century, the fall of like centrally planned economies very clearly. And now I think we're up against the centrally planned lawyering system. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how we can, I like how you said poly, as opposed to decentralized, polycentric law, and how we would do that while maintaining a union.
Right.
How do you foresee that?
I'm not sure we maintain a union. I mean, you know, every system lives for as long as it lives. Back in college, I double majored. I was computer science, but also Roman history.
Oh.
And one of my professors, I think Barry Strauss, had a wonderful last lecture in the semester one year. And, you know, he was talking about the parallels between the Roman system and the American system. And, you know, he said a few things that, you know, every country ends eventually. But also its forms linger on after the reality of it has died. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, sort of red-gray tribe will say, you know, America's gone so far off the rails, but we'll get it back. And I'm like, you know, dude, I think America ended somewhere between 10 and 50 years ago. And right now, you know, we still have the form of it.
Some people argue it ended with the Federal Reserve.
I think that's, you know, I don't particularly have the Federal Reserve bug, that, you know, that explains everything. But I can get along with those guys. You know, I think that, there's good arguments that, not Coolidge. Anyway, I'm blanking in my early 20th
Woodrow
century.
Wilson?
Yes, thank you very much, sir. And there's another argument to go further back that Abraham Lincoln and, you know, even if freeing the slaves was a wonderful ideal, it's interesting how every other country on the planet managed to free its slaves without having a war and killing 3% of its population.
Yeah, and many before us.
Yeah.
Like the British Empire.
Exactly. Perfect example.
Great Britain proper, I think, was in the 1700s.
Yep.
What was it, like 73 or something, or 75?
I would have thought it was later than that, but I'll trust your number.
I could be wrong. I know that in the greater Commonwealth, it was 1833. I could be wrong.
That's the number I had in my head.
It's funny because they freed their slaves, but they still had like colonized India completely.
Right.
So like.
right. You know, and the United States is an example of that. But, you know, we talk about, you know, we're this exemplar for all mankind, this wonderful free society where anybody can do anything, you know, as long as it's in the properly approved narrow set of things that are good and free, not, you know, terrible bad things like, you know, going to church and having old-fashioned ideas or owning firearms or anything. And yet we have this crazy system where members of both parties sort of support this imperial warmongering system where we're fighting in, you know, 30 or 40 different countries. So we've got this representative government and all these freedoms at home to some degree, while simultaneously we have, you know, absolute, you know,
unfettered.
Yes, unfettered. That'll do. You know, we have this effective war on anyone we want to, and there's no checks and balances, and there's no civil rights.
It's crazy to me how at a certain point the United States, the politicians stopped actually implementing policy in this country, and mm-hmm. it was actually an argument over what we should be doing overseas.
Right.
And we had a long period of that. From my mind. Look, I can't argue for about what happened before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
But I know most of my life was just a whole lot of arguing about what we're going to do to other people
right.
elsewhere.
Right.
And I long complained. I'm like, everybody's coming out talking about these pipes in Flint, mm-hmm. which now I believe are fixed. But I'm mm-hmm. like, how much money did we spend in Afghanistan building roads and building schools?
Right.
So it's weird to me that the answer to a lot of what the left was complaining about was simply that we focus on America first, mm-hmm, which mm-hmm. is controversial, I guess, for some strange reason. But I want to go back to this point about, you know, Katie Hopkins in Australia, because you mentioned there might not be a union.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering if these countries are effectively shutting their borders off,
mm-hmm.
they're making it much, much more difficult for anyone to come in. What is it going to look like if the United States isn't even going to be a union, but then it's already hard enough for people to travel? It feels like everybody is becoming more isolationist.
Yeah. You know, so there's an interesting thing where things are getting physically more isolated, you know, in the physical realm of where can you go, at the same time that distance is becoming less important. And this is the whole sort of Lexus and the olive tree thesis that, you know, the world is getting flat and, you know, you can source parts from wherever and you can, you know, I work for a startup that doesn't have a physical location. We're decentralized and we've got people, you know, all the way from Italy over to Japan. So we've just got this sort of weird rolling 20-hour clock. But, you know, this gets to what I was saying earlier about, you know, every 500 years or so, maybe there's a deep fundamental change in how society is structured. Now, getting to COVID, I think that this is a short-term problem. There's, you know, we sequenced COVID-19 in very short order, and we came up with a immunization for it in, you know, 48 hours. And the only thing that stood in the way was the old, you know, nation states and the FDA and the CDC. You know, doing things like taking 4-day weekends during the emergency, where you can count the number of people dying per day, but they're so entrenched in the sort of 1970s Soviet bureaucratic thing of, oh, we've all got to get out to our dachas. You know, this is, you know, Soviet pioneer day. You can't expect us to work and save lives then. So I think that's proof that the system is absolutely exhausted and it's just ready for people to stop believing it.
When you look at the sheer tribalism, you know, like I mentioned, and many people have mentioned, Joe Biden seems to only be talking to one side of the country at this mm-hmm. point, because they've basically resigned themselves. Okay, we can't win them over. It's mm-hmm. over. We're done talking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the tribalism has reached absolutely absurd levels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like that right now that people are circulating these old tweets from 2020 of Kamala Harris and like Daily Coast writing about vaccine skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying like, who would take Trump's vaccine? And now right. they're the ones screaming like, why won't Trump supporters take the
right.
vaccine?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, people are absolutely aligned. I got to say, you know, perhaps I'm just biased, but I think it is fair to say that it is the rule for the establishment left, but the exception for the right in general. Mm-hmm. So leftists kind of overlap with a lot of the establishment Democrats. But you look at, you mentioned the Republican Party and their, you know, forever war kind of stuff too.
Mm-hmm. I want to make clear that I don't think that's just the Republicans. I mean, both parties
love
the forever war.
But I will say, like, I think as another sign of the collapse or the decay or the change, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it, is Donald Trump's storming into the Republican Party and mm-hmm. forcing dramatic changes.
Right. And
Trump
supporters, he couldn't have done that in 1980 or 1984.
Right.
You can't, one man with a bunch of bombast can't knock over a healthy system.
But the Trump supporters, I don't know if did you hear what Michael Moore said back in 2016?
I think I did. I remember being shocked that he was sort of intellectually honest about it. For the first time I had some respect for him.
It was brilliant. He basically said that Trump was one of the only people advocating for these factories.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to these auto manufacturers and said, I will tariff you 30% if you try and move these cars out mm-hmm. of America. And then Michael Moore said, the workers look at Donald Trump like a human Molotov cocktail,
mm-hmm.
and they are going to send the biggest F you to the establishment the world has ever heard, and they
yep.
are going to enjoy it. The one thing he got wrong was he was like, it'll feel good for a week
mm-hmm.
or a month.
That felt good
maybe
for 4 years.
Year. I know, yeah, it felt good for a lot of people for a uh-huh. while. So I think that's one of the big changes to the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, so just to address that point, on the left, you have many people who are, it's crazy how they can't remember what they said last year.
You know, I started flipping back through 1984 recently, and everyone's read 1984. And there's a problem with reading things. You tend to boil them down to an essence or a logo or something, and things in the world, books, novels, people, have a whole lot of complexity. So to actually go back and look at 1984, it's not just sort of a stand-in or a stereotype or a glyph that stands for repressive totalitarianism. There's a lot of detail there. And the detail about how the party just changes the line and everyone, you know, switches on a dime.
Amazing.
And this is what we're seeing. You know, last year, you know, I was one of these internet autists who was paying attention to China in very, very early January. And I think it was late January when, you know, I started tweeting to my 10,000, you know, I'm talking to Tim Pool about, I've got 10,000 followers on Twitter. but I said, you know, guys, now is the time to start packing, stockpiling stuff. And people said, you know what? And I said, you know, I don't know that, you know, if it's surfaces, but start getting latex gloves in case it does turn out to be surfaces. I don't know if it's airborne, but definitely start getting masks, you know, P90, P95. Start laying in food. I'm not saying there will be supply chain disruptions, but when you don't know. And at that time, the left and, oh gosh, what was he?
Ezra Klein?
Yes, thank you. I think it was either Ezra Klein, or if it wasn't Ezra Klein, it was one of the other Ezra Kleins, was absolutely poo-pooing this idea of, you know, masks do nothing, and even if they do anything, you should leave it for the professionals. There's no reason to have a mask, and the fear that you'll generate, that's the real danger. And then they all pivot on a dime when, you know, the new line comes down from the, you know, there used to be journalist, if you're familiar with that, you know, 10 or whatever.
The journalist.
The journalist.
Oh, yeah, there's more than people know, man.
Right, and so certainly there are dozens more journalists, and when you see...
Let's break that down real quick.
Sure.
He's not saying journalist, he's saying journo-list. This was, I think Ezra Klein made this, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was a Facebook group where all of these different journalists from different organizations were on one community group together. So one person would come in and say, X happened. And then every single journalist would, you know, in this group would see it. So they were all wrapped up in the exact same bubble narrative, completely oblivious to the outside world.
There's a wonderful video on YouTube that shows some people on a cable channel reading out a prepared statement, and like every 5 seconds it switches to a different cable channel and the statement continues seamlessly because this was literally a memo that came down from corporate and they wanted every local affiliate to do it. Journalist was effectively the same thing, but there wasn't a corporation at the top. There was just this little clade or file or hive of journalists, and now, they had Tamara's bullet points every day.
What people don't realize about that is there wasn't one journalist. There was probably 10,000.
Right.
I was personally on several of them.
Yeah, I think I still am on one.
There were a bunch of different ones. There was one that was about, it was like, citizen journalist centric. So it was basically 10 or 20,000 people with several who were very active and many who just followed. And they would post things and they would all see it. And then sure enough, these articles pop up everywhere. Mm-hmm. But I do want to, with that being said, go back to the point you were making about, you know, it's time to prepare. It's time to buy supplies because Early on last year, you know, we have one of the sponsors we often do is for a food bucket.
Awesome.
Safe and Ready Meals.
Mm-hmm.
This is not, I'm not promoting them. I'm just mentioning that we have promoted them in the past. And this is like a 25-year food bucket.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't like doing promos, like legit people, like I'll get sent like, hey, Tim, would you want to advertise for this? And I'm like, no, I can't do that company. You know, like I have to actually think there's utility there. And so this company I thought was actually fantastic because the way I describe it to people is, you know, you've got a first aid kit, right?
Oh, I've got multiple first aid
right.
kits.
How many?
But
I don't know, 4 or 5, including trauma bandages. I go into that in my books in that, you know, I've got a small first aid kit in my workshop. I've got a beefier first aid kit in my chainsaw supplies.
Yeah. All right. Now here's a question though.
Sure.
How often do you use them?
You know, there's sort of the 80-20 rule or the power law in that, you know, I probably cut my fingertips or something every, you know, 2 weeks or so. I think I actually did it.
Once every 2 weeks?
Yeah.
You might need a bandage.
Right.
But how often do you eat food?
Right. Yeah, you know, three times a day.
Yes, three times a day. And so it was crazy to me that, you know, that there's this negative connotation, this negative perspective on having emergency food or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you should have a thing of water, food, and a first aid kit. And you know, you look at what happened with, there was around the time, I don't remember when this was, there was flooding in Houston. Do you remember? It was really,
absolutely,
really bad. And I'm like, some of these people are like trapped in their houses for a long period of time. You're going to be happy you can crack open that freeze dried sealed bag. And now you're going to need some power to boil the water and stuff like that, you know. But I look at it like, it was strange to me that the establishment doesn't prepare for anything.
Right.
You know, you mentioned they turn on a dime.
Mm-hmm.
The party says, so be it. And they all just agree. And they're all in this mentality that no matter what happens, they will always be safe. And that to me is insane.
Absolutely.
You know what I think? Here's what I always say about buying beans and rice or these emergency food kits. If you're in your absolute worst case scenario, okay, admittedly, your worst case, you have food, right? You know, but in the absolute best case scenario, you literally, you just eat it.
Yeah.
Like I used to say, look, worst case scenario, just eat the food, right? And then I realized, no, the worst case scenario would be the actual apocalypse, and then you'll eat the food.
Right.
But if you buy these things and then nothing happens, The other day, I just cracked it open and made some stroganoff. It was mm-hmm. delicious. Put some chicken in there and some spices.
And I've absolutely done the same thing, not recently, but, you know, I've had a pile, you know, one or two boxes of MREs sitting around the house forever since, you know, shortly after I got out of college. And, you know, every now and then you'd be sort of working late and suddenly it's 10 o'clock and there's no food in the fridge and there's no takeout. You know, I've eaten an MRE at 10:30 in the evening more than once. So.
Yeah. You know, it's not something you want to eat all the time, right. But they're not bad.
Yeah, it's good self-limiting in that way. You're never going to be tempted to eat up all of your MREs.
But let's talk about this. You know, right now, you mentioned in the previous segment that we could be coming to this 500-year end cycle. I mean, you've heard of the fourth turning. Thucydides trap, and now we've got that MIT study that everyone's talking about. Mm-hmm. 2040, the collapse is coming or whatever.
There's yet another one. I'm going to mispronounce the word, but it's like Korolev wave theory.
And we should add it to the list. We can talk about that one.
You know, I think I ended up picking this up from an interstitial essay in a book of John Barnes' short stories like 30 years ago. And the idea is that there's a bunch of different waves, sort of sinusoids, and some have 4-year cycles, another 12. And, you know, at some point, if you've ever, you know, taken calculus or done a Fourier, you know, decomposition of something, you get a whole bunch of curves and they start to peak up at certain points. And, you know, the theory is that all of these curves are going to peak, you know, sometime way off in the far future, like 2025 or something. And you know, this theory is written down in the 70s or 80s. And I think we're seeing a lot of it come true. You know, stuff is getting crazy.
So do you think, you know, you mentioned last year you said people should buy stuff.
Yeah.
What would you say right now? Do you think people should be stocking up or something like that?
Let me back up a little bit and say,
avoid, you know, panic, right?
Yeah, yeah. Panic never helps anything. I think that anti-fragility is a good thing. And
yes.
Sort of the Nassim Taleb.
Love that
thing.
Idea.
And so, you know, people ask, are you a prepper? I'm like, well, you know, I'm not prepared to survive the zombie apocalypse. I don't want to survive a nuclear war.
You don't want to.
You know, I'm saying maybe for humor. I'd rather not die if there is a nuclear war. But the point is, all sorts of things happen, and it's always better to be prepared for them. One thing I talk about, just, you know, this isn't a survivalist or a prepper book, and I've got some sort of anti-prepping thoughts.
And that's
almost.
Escape from the City.
Right, Escape from the City. And this is a recent homesteading book that I wrote. I've been on the homestead for 8 years, and there's two volumes, Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Wow.
And it's basically one long book, about 1,300 pages long.
Wow.
And the, you know, and it's sort of massive in the amount of detail inside. You know, the table of contents alone is 30 pages. So if you've got any interest in homesteading or prepping, I'd recommend picking it up. It's Escape the City. It's on Amazon. And you can just Google it.
They made prepping a dirty word.
Yeah. You know, the problem with anything is that it gets an ideological stink. And so there's always this constant recycling of language, whether it's the name of for a minority or, you know, intellectually challenged person or a hobby, you know. And so, you know, prepping, there's always an impetus in the media to find someone and point at them and laugh, and then everyone laughs along with you. And, you know, sort of the journalist goes out that we all agree as a society that, you know, preppers or furries or whatever, you know, we can punch down at them because they're a bunch of weirdos, in the same way that we're punching down at people who were buying masks last January. So anyway, my thoughts about prepping are there's a power law in that absolute huge catastrophic things happen very, very rarely, but sort of very small annoyances happen more often. So if someone says, you know, I want to be prepared, what should I do? Should I get a Zombie Hunter Extreme machete? Should I get a long-range sniper rifle? I'm like, you know, maybe you should get $500 in the checking account because, you know, people get laid off like once every 5 years. So you're going to be laid off from your job, you know, in the next 5 years, certainly in the next 10 years. So lock down how you're going to survive that without, you know, losing your lifestyle. You know, people lose their power once every 10 or 15 years. Plan for that. And that's not expensive. You get a $500 generator, a $300 transfer switch. But then you keep going out on these things, and they're less and less frequent. But the chance, you know, hopefully we'll all live to be 70 or 80 or 90. And a thing that only happens once every 15 years, that's going to happen to you several times in your life. And we in the West, we've been, you know, rich and protected by oceans. And so we've been very, you know, blessed. And we've not had a lot of the bad stuff that normal people have at the same rate that they have it. But I wrote this book starting several years ago, and one thing I said is, hey, we get plagues about once every 100 years. We had the Spanish flu in 1918, and I went back several other plagues. So you should be prepared, because there's a decent chance that there'll be a plague in your lifetime.
Did you hear about this story happened several years ago. There was an algal bloom mm-hmm. in the Great Lakes,
mm-hmm.
and within 40 – which is Toledo on the lake? I can't remember which city
it's
it was.
Like Western Ohio.
But is on
Cleveland's
one of the Great Lakes.
On the lake.
Cleveland.
Sandusky's on the lake.
There was, within 40 miles, I guess, of all these cities,
mm-hmm.
no drinking water.
Wow.
Wow.
Because what happened was, as soon as the news broke, as soon as people found out, they immediately started raiding local stores for bottled water and moving further and further out to get more and more water. And then within 40 miles, no water. What do you drink?
My wife made a really interesting point that one of the reasons to prep is not because it's the only way to get the supplies. The reason to prep is so that you don't have to make terrible trade-offs when you need the supplies. And, you know, the terrible trade-off could be as simple as paying $10 a gallon for gasoline to run your generator. Or it could be a lot worse. And I mean, you know, people, especially women in refugee camps all the time have to make terrible trade-offs.
You know, I went crazy with vinegar and salt. And people are laughing. And honey, like 100 pounds of honey. Because if it does go down, I want to provide it for the neighbors. I want the entire community to be preserved as much as possible so that we can barter. So that if they have all the ammo, if they have, you know, whatever, we can all kind of come together. And those things become extremely valuable.
Ian bought an absurd amount of salt, vinegar, and honey.
Never go bad.
Yep. And we laugh mostly at the vinegar. Mostly the vinegar. Because, like, I don't know what you do with it. However, I do understand it can be used for a lot of chemical processes. So it's a funny idea that you'd have so much vinegar, because how often do you really use it in some recipes? But in actuality, it lasts forever, doesn't it?
As far as I know,
It does, and I'm going to jump in and defend Ian, because when you've got vinegar, you can pickle anything.
That's
so
true.
When your harvest comes in all over 4 weeks, but you want to store it for the winter, you know, just pile that under vinegar. And
is that all you do? You just put vinegar?
Yeah.
I thought you needed brine.
Brine is salt, so Ian's covered there
No, exactly. I mean, honey never goes bad.
Right.
Salt crystallizes. Salt is you definitely need salt. Like,
doesn't really
you know,
go
where
bad,
where
yeah.
where would you get your salt in your diet if you're, you know, in an area like this, you know, in Appalachia? Is salt naturally occurring? Or what?
If there was a disaster or something and you had to improvise, I would go with road salt. But other than that, you know, you're going to be trading people who are, you know, bringing in salt from the ocean.
Salt was the currency at one point 5,000-6,000 years ago.
I was thinking about this earlier because we bought some deer salt licks.
Oh, yeah.
You just, you know, chuck them out and leave on them or something. And I see the deer is going nuts from because there's no salt.
Right.
And so the deer, when they find salt, there's a warning on it saying, make sure you put out several, otherwise the deer will fight each other to get it. Because there's no salt. So imagine if you didn't have salt.
Yep.
See, this is the crazy thing. People don't realize. Even, you know, we get out of the city. We're in the middle of nowhere. People still don't realize that we're dependent on so much. Like vitamin C, for instance. I don't know where we would source vitamin C out here. We could probably try and grow some stuff. Maybe because we're more modernized, we can grow stuff indoors and try and grow some citrus or something. But where would we get vitamin C? What's your recommendation on that?
For that, I I'm not a super prepper, but rose hips have vitamin C, and we've got roses in the yard. So, you know.
Got wild rose hips.
Yeah.
Just eat a bunch of roses.
Yeah.
Wow.
Boil it into tea.
Yep.
Absolutely. That'd be a good way to do it. Can you boil grass? Can you work with grass for food? I know you can't eat it directly because of the excessive cellulose.
Yeah, I don't think there's many calories in grass. I would feed grass to my sheep and then eat the sheep. So
that'd work, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the easiest way to do it. Chickens eat grass.
Yes, they do.
But they can't subsist off of grass, right?
You know, chickens will get a lot of their calories from bugs and worms.
Yeah.
And so we've got our chickens in a pen, but there's a thing that a lot of people do, which is a chicken tractor. And that has nothing to do with a diesel-powered tractor. It's basically a mobile pen with wheels on it. And the idea is that you put your chickens in this pen, and then you just go out and either with your riding mower or your tractor or just by hand, you move it 10 or 15 feet a day.
Chicken city on wheels.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah, people have recommended it. And I've heard that people will put it over where they want to farm.
Let
the chickens tear it up, then move it, and then you can plant stuff in it, and they fertilize it.
So I've got a thought about this, and this is something I go into my book. There's some utility in this. You know, chickens are great. Pigs are great. I don't have pigs this year, but in general, I have pigs like every other year. But people sometimes want to say, oh, man, you know, and this is sort of like after a deep bong hit, you know, the system, you know, nature gives you everything you need, man. The pigs will furrow, you know, they'll turn up the soil for you so you don't need to till. And there's a little bit of truth here, but there's a whole lot more wishful thinking. And I've never seen anyone who says that pigs will till your soil who actually have their own pigs. It's to some degree wishful thinking.
So the pigs are no good.
Pigs are great, but pigs do not replace tractors or rototillers or plows.
Yeah. So if you know, what should the average person be buying, like in time? Well, let me slow down. We were previously talking about a dramatic change in the system. Let's start from there. What does this change look like? Do you think we've talked a lot about like balkanization?
Yeah.
Where I want to be clear on this. It's like the political factions basically choose their specific region and they break apart and move. do you think it's something like that? What do you think we're
right.
looking at?
So, you know, first of all, I don't want to really be certain about this. I always find people who are absolutely certain to be a little, you know, I've got a head-scratching attitude about that, that, you know, I don't know, man, you haven't seen the future. But I think the interesting thing about information technology, whether we're talking about the Gutenberg press or whether we're talking about, you know, TCP/IP or Twitter or whatever, is that it connects people who are further and further apart with lower and lower latency. So if you want to look at like 1776, you know, people in different towns in Massachusetts had a lot more in common with each other than they had with people back in, you know, Wales or, you know, various parts of England, because they could only communicate with a few letters, you know, with a latency of 6 months or so. And so that made it very easy for the regions to sort of grow apart and have their own political cultures. And the weird thing about the high-speed connection we have is that we have, you know, two tribes, obviously red and blue, but then a lot more tribes. You know, if you go to, you know, some furry
yellow.
Fandom thing, right, yellow. You know, you pick anything, whether it's, you know, Mustang engine, you know, modification community, or whether it's preppers, or whether, you know, it's anything.
Guns.
Yeah, you'll find that these tribes are geographically distributed. So I think that we might be headed to a world where the Westphalian nation state, where all of the nations have crisp little borders around them, is perhaps fading, and we're going to a new world where the tribes are interleaved and distributed across and on top of each other.
I've been thinking a lot about that dissolution of the nation state mm-hmm. since about 2006, really yeah. since internet video, when I realized how powerful and connected mm-hmm. we are now with video chat. Like, how do you see it happening without a... Because the downside was, I don't want a one-world government that's totalitarian.
Right.
Now I'm looking at more of a decentralized localization. Mm-hmm. I mean, you obviously work with crypto. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you see something like that working?
Right. You know, again, you know, I'm going to say I can speculate since you're asking me to speculate. You know, if you go back to the medieval period, there was this interesting thing where there was less of a crisp boundary in the Westphalian sense. You might have somebody who was a, you know, the example I said before the show started is you could imagine that there was someone, you know, peddling out on the street, and the guards come up and say, hey, it's Sunday, you can't sell stuff. And he, you know, holds up his warrant and he says, you know, actually, I'm a Jew, so I'm, you know, bound by different
doctrine,
right, religious code, but I'm also tied in a little bit to your political system, and I've got a warrant from the Duke who says, you know, yes, I'm a Jew with his permission, I'm doing things. And the answer is, oh, okay, so you're on the same territory as people who are under this other power, but you're under a different sort of chain of command.
Whoa.
And
I can't imagine that being a good thing.
You know, when the world changes, good or bad doesn't really matter. You know, it comes out of incentives.
Nope.
I think it might be a decent thing.
I think we're going that way.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the racial identitarianism from the establishment in mm-hmm. this country, and it really does look like that's where we're going.
Yeah. I mean, you know, right now we're already in that. You know, one person at Harvard is under a different law than someone else, depending on, you know, his skin color, you know, his admission there, the behavioral norms that's expected and everything else.
Or actually, you can't even get into Harvard if you're Asian for
right.
the most part. So,
right.
yeah, absolutely. Different rules just yeah. based on what you look like.
And, you know, I there's little hints of that, you know, if someone is from overseas and they've got diplomatic plates, we're here, you know, not too far from D.C. And I saw that. So I think that polycentric law overlapping in the same geographic location is something that has happened before in the Middle Ages, and I think it could happen again. Not making a strong prediction. And this ties into, we were talking about anarcho-capitalism, and one of the sort of leading luminaries of anarcho-capitalism is David Friedman, the son of Milton Friedman. And he's written a bunch of great books on the topic. The seminal one is The Machinery of Freedom, which was one of the books that, along with Robert Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, really sort of created my worldview. But he's written some other good ones, Law's Order, and one I read a few months ago was Legal Systems Very Different from Our Own. So I'm not sure. We'll see what happens over the coming decades.
I could see like an augmented reality system mm-hmm. where when you look around, people have like a different aura if they're under different jurisdiction
right.
law or something. But my wonder is, what if the power goes out? Would that system function? Could it function? Do you think it's
right.
something that...
You know, what if the power goes out gets back to sort of robustness and anti-fragility? And, you know, I expect that long-term technology is going to stick around and that we will be living in a hyper-networked world. So that sort of pulls in the opposite direction of the sort of localism and the anti-fragile homesteading that we're talking about. So I don't know. You know, in investing, some people talk about a barbell strategy where you want to have a lot of your money in sort of safe, reasonable things like index funds, but you also want to have a small amount in really potential high payoff bets. You know, this is the venture capital model. And politically, looking towards the future, on the one hand, you know, sort of, I hope for everyone has, you know, human rights and the power grid stays up and the food supplies are good. But I also have sheep that I can eat in my own orchard, and I can make my own wine in case it goes bad.
We got to get off the grid. We're getting off a centralized economy, centralized law, centralized electricity. It's got to be polycentric.
You know a lot about Rome.
I know some, yeah.
When Rome collapsed,
right.
the as you mentioned before, latency, mm-hmm. you know, distance between communications right. was very a very long time.
Absolutely.
And then you end up with their own political cultures, and mm-hmm. then you mentioned now we're in this, you know, new era of technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be really interesting, in my opinion, just to elaborate on that idea, when you have, you know, one faction of people, maybe it's a family, and they're anarcho-capitalists,
mm-hmm.
and they're online communicating with the anarcho-capitalist community. But they're decentralized. Their neighbor is a socialist. Their other neighbor is a conservative, you know, free enterprise sort of, but still some government control. How will there be cohesive law
right.
if people right next to each other are just
yeah. No,
at odds?
It's a great question, and I'll take a stab at answering it. But I want to be clear that I'm not predicting that. Like, this is definitely the way it's going to happen. David Friedman talked about this, and he is the one who came up with sort of polycentric legal order. And what he said is, you, Tim, might subscribe to one legal system where you want to keep trespassers off your land. That's pretty important to you. Someone else might subscribe to a legal system that has a English right to roam. And then in England, apparently, if you've got a certain amount of land, you can't keep people off of it. They're allowed to just walk right across as the sort of traditional right of the Englishman. So what happens when these, things come in conflict? Like one guy says, I've got an absolute right to walk across your backyard, and you say, I've got an absolute right to keep you out. And, theoretically, someone who wanted to diss on anarcho-capitalism would say, well, and then of course you'd get a gun battle, and that's why anarcho-capitalism is the worst possible political ideology in the world. But, in the real world, when corporations run into things like, you've stolen my intellectual property because I think that my patent on, how resistors work is, blah, blah, blah. And you say, no, I'm using a different thing. It looks similar, but it's not. We don't get guns and duke this out. We just hire lawyers
lawsuits.
And they settle it. So I think that would happen. Now the next parody is, okay, Travis is arguing that anytime two people have a disagreement about trespassing in a garden, like is there an easement or is there not, then there's a $90,000 lawsuit that takes 3 years. And I think there's game theory where when something is iterated, there is not a need to hash it out time and time and time again. Both sides see, really a negotiated solution here and some rules of the road make sense. So if you look at any place where firms interact, they either come up with their own laws or they come up with their own governance bodies to help them interact with each other. Because, if you look at evolution, animals don't battle to the death with each other. When you've got two rams and they both want to, dominate the herd of ewes, it doesn't make sense if one ram is aiming to kill the other because he's likely to get severely damaged in that. The utility maximizing compromise is some sort of dominance display and head bashing, and then one of them sulks off because he can live to try again another day. And I think people are not idiots. People do not get into gun battles.
I somewhat disagree. You look, we talked about the wacky laws, recently, where you've got some places where it's like, you can't take a shower on Tuesdays.
Mm.
And it actually made sense because back in the day, the local aquifer was like,
mm-hmm.
we have to have one day where nobody uses water so it can replenish a little bit. But now we have better water systems. We have tons of water. So we produce these laws based on the specifics that are happening in our areas.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a community and they build a culture. They build rules and laws for each other, by each other, and sometimes in disagreement with each other, but understanding the problem. Hey, look, a bear keeps coming in, so we're going to pass a law. You can't have picnic baskets
right.
lying around wherever. Well, now you've got somebody who's on the internet, and he does not subscribe to any of his immediate community. When they go outside, they're clashing, and one guy's on nothing but socialist forms, and one guy's on nothing but, ANCAP forms, and so they're completely at odds locally. I don't necessarily think that they would just agree to resolve
right.
the solution because the resolution itself is part of the local community
sure.
and culture and law.
That's a great argument, and I follow it, and it's convincing. And so now the great thing about, pontificating while sitting on my butt is I can say, okay, if you didn't like that answer, I've got another one. And the other one is that just as the cost of information transmission is falling, the cost of picking up and moving your butt is falling. I moved from Massachusetts, where the local community and the norms and the politics were very much not to my liking, and I moved to New Hampshire 8 years ago. And,
A lot of ANCAPs in New Hampshire.
There are. There's a joke. You know, I don't know if I would necessarily say that I'm part of the Free State Project, but I'm certainly FSP adjacent, and I know a lot of FSP people. And there's a joke, you know, what's the difference between a libertarian and an ANCAP? And the answer is, you know, 6 months in New Hampshire. So, you know, I think picking up and moving to be around people who are like you, is a good thing. And there's a phrase, the great sort, which is mostly talking about demographics and mating, but I think that to some degree it's also happening geographically.
I completely agree. I mean, look at how many people moved to Texas recently.
Right.
Joe Rogan, Elon Musk announced it, yep. But a ton of people, there's a lot of regular people that moved. And one of the things I've warned, though, is that while, you know, Joe Rogan and Elon Musk are, they seem to be left-leaning individuals. I mean, mm-hmm. Elon Musk calls himself a socialist, whether mm-hmm. he is or not. I don't know. It's funny considering he's a master troll.
That's what
right,
he is.
Right, right. But the people they bring with them, when mm-hmm. they move their companies and their jobs, they bring people with them in their periphery who are definitely not going to agree with exactly what happens there in Texas. But I digress. You know, that being said, I do think there's a great sort happening. I mean, look, we moved effectively to West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
I was living in New York City only a few years ago, moved to the Philly suburbs. Now we're in the mountains, you know, essentially. Yeah. I say that because
it's
we're in the tri-state.
By the way, I loved the drive out here.
Saw the deer. Every day I look outside, there's a family of deer doing mm-hmm. their thing. And, you know, I wanted to get away from the city. So we move closer and closer to people who are more and more like-minded. For me, I would say, it's not necessarily that the people around here are like-minded, but we agree to leave each other alone,
right?
Which
right.
is big.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, where I keep finding a problem regarding this whole concept of decentralized law is if a community wants to pollute the air, because that can affect the entire globe if it's done on a mass enough scale. If they're pumping methane and carbon and, you know, radioactive materials up into the atmosphere to produce just pure industry, like hundreds of thousands of people, like for decades, could just destroy things like thousands of miles away.
China.
Or polluting the water, like the ocean, like dumping. So
a lot of the plastic waste. India and China.
I was going to go there next.
Yeah, India and China, plastic waste.
We've got all of these rules against having, you know, plastic straws in the U.S., and really it's all coming from just one small place.
So are we ultimately, will we need a global, like an overseer?
So, you know, my answer to this is that freedom can only exist on the frontier. And, you know, America has got a really unique libertarian culture. You find a few libertarians in other places, but it's endemic to, you know, the United States. And that's because of our culture. We ran into a, you know, quote unquote empty, which is, you know, the Western Hemisphere was empty because of the tragedy of communicable diseases. But we evolved this idea of a frontier because we had a frontier. And that's why you can sort of never really communicate about some of these topics with people in other parts of the country. And so, if I may plug something else, Tim introduced me as an author, and the first things I wrote before the homesteading books were two anarcho-capitalistic novels, which pretty much have the thesis that we can only achieve freedom out on the frontier. So the first one is The Powers of the Earth, which won the Prometheus Award for Best Novel in 2018, and the sequel is Causes of Separation, which won the Prometheus Award in 2019.
I think you are correct about that with the freedom. The way I've described it is, you know how gases, the molecules, you know, are bouncing around quite mm-hmm. a bit, liquids a little bit, and then mm-hmm. solids, they're rigid.
Yep.
When you look at big cities, I view it as a solid.
Yeah.
All of these individuals stacked on top of each other, and that room to bounce around erratically, that's your freedom.
Yep.
The more people surround you, the more you push, and it compresses your sphere of freedom. So it's actually a really, really easy way to explain it.
I love your analogy, and because I'm a nerd, I'm going to make it a little nerdier,
all
which
right.
is the ideal gas law, which is PV equals NRT. And, you know, it's a great analogy because one thing that happens when you add more molecules that have this kinetic energy or when you crush them in tighter space is the temperature goes up.
Right.
And, yeah, absolutely.
Or the system expands.
Right. You know, so we can go to the sort of the Carnot cycle that it pushes out and, you know, the piston.
But we're talking about compression, so that energy is getting released.
Yeah.
And the easiest way to explain it is just playing the drums.
Mm-hmm.
That in order to play the drums, you need a massive sphere of freedom. You can't do it in the suburbs. You might be able to, but you have to get permission. You have to ask, hey, you guys mind if we're playing the drums? I know, you know, the zoning laws say that, you know, the ordinance says I can be noisy until 10 p.m., but then your neighbors get mad at you, and then you're fighting with your neighbors. You talk to them. They'll say, okay, play the drums, but only between this hours. Or, okay, make noise, but only between this hours. You can't play drums in the city.
Right.
You got one person above you, one to your left, to your right, and one behind you. And you play the drums, and they're going to be like, are you nuts? It's not about I can sort of hear it. It's you're literally banging next door to me. Like, turn your music. It's a movie trope.
The
so people are stacked on top of each other. There's no room for freedoms.
I absolutely agree. One of the, you know, there's a dozen or five dozen reasons that I don't want to live in a city and I can't stand the city. But one of them is that I'm an introvert. And, you know, I know people who often propose systems. Like, I've got one friend who is proposing a hackerspace, and my answer to a hackerspace is I have a hackerspace. It's my garage. And I've got, you know, MIG welders and, you know, bandsaws and lathes and everything I want to do. And so anytime I want to do a project, the tools are there and I'm first in line and don't have to wait for anyone else. And I think that one of the reasons that he likes the idea of a hackerspace is because all of these things are up for negotiation. We get to come together as a community and decide the rules for how we should do this. And we get to come together as a community. So what I would see as a cost, which is the interactions and the negotiations, is for him a benefit. And I think a lot of people who love cities actually love the fact that you have to negotiate everything. You know, they talk about, you know, a certain sense of community and, you know, that, and that's what makes New York City great. The fact that when, you know, one person vomits on the subway, that everyone else helps everyone else walk around it. I don't like interacting. So if I want to play the drums and get my Neil Peart on, you know, I don't want to have to talk to 10 other people about it.
Regarding PVNRT, this is a little bit of an aside. I'd like to hear what you think about this. When you increase the pressure, it either is going to enhance the temperature or expand the system.
Yep.
But it's just for tubular systems, the way that was written out to get water. I think it's to get water out of wells or something.
So, you know, PV equals NRT, the ideal gas law, is what you would use to describe a piston in a cylinder, whether it's an internal combustion engine or a Stirling engine. But it would also apply to, say, a balloon.
So is it possible that as the balloon expands, it causes the expansion causes friction, which is energy from outside of the system, to cause it to heat up faster, which causes it to expand faster, which causes more friction, which causes more heat and a faster, so you get acceleration or inflation. And so it
Right. I think what you're saying is that the more people live in close proximity, the faster the acceleration towards collapse?
Well, maybe. What I'm getting at is I think that in order to explain free energy, this is totally off topic. I'm sorry, but I want to talk about PVNRT.
We got to move on
order,
from that.
Okay, but in order to get free energy, to explain to the people scientifically, we need to explain inflation in PVNRT.
I was an analogy for people smashed on top of each other and then fighting with each other.
If they have nowhere
the streets
to go, it's going to raise the temperature.
So I think it's going to happen sooner. This excitement, this collapse, this rage. One thing people need to realize is that we're in a lull period. With the election for the president was last year. There's no real cycle right now. This year is where everyone kind of just like is exhausted. 2022 is the midterms. 2023 is the presidential primary cycle, followed by 24, the presidential cycle. And that is going to be ramping up worse.
Absolutely.
More extreme than we saw. But I do want to show this story real quick. And the story itself, I think, is important. I don't think it's the most excitable story. It's from NBC. All children should wear masks in school this fall, even if vaccinated, according to Pediatrics Group. The American Academy of Pediatrics is calling the new guidance a layered approach. We had Steve Bannon on the show.
Nice.
He said on August 15th, when mothers start learning about what their children are being taught, there is going to be, a ruckus or I don't know the exact word, but you know, you get the point. It's like people are going to lose it. And he's right. I think a lot of the critical race theory stuff is going to result in moms being shocked and angered. But this
it's already happening. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, consider when kids are back in school, summer ends. I saw this story and I saw it on Reddit and I looked at the comments because the first thing I thought when I saw that that schools wanted to make kids wear masks, even if they're vaccinated, my immediate thought was, there is no way even the establishment leftists, the people who march on a dime for the establishment, are going to be okay with this. Because even though we have seen to great lengths these people are willing to contort themselves, this will snap their brains like a rubber band. And I was right. Surprisingly, the top comments on Reddit, which is mostly leftists, were like, I can't do this anymore. I can't handle this.
Yep.
One response was, I'm a high school teacher. This is insane. I will not be the mask police. I can't handle this. And it was just inundated people saying, this is nuts. It's gone too far. We're losing control. But the funny thing is, they were trying to adhere to the narrative.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
We have to do it. But their brains were just at that point where the rubber band was going to snap. Seeing the person say, I'm a high school teacher and I just can't handle it anymore. And I'm like, whether they want to support the narrative or not, the rubber band is going to snap back and then something's going to happen. I don't know what.
Yep.
Maybe you know, actually stabilizes things.
I see a lot of doom posting on Twitter from my tribe talking about, oh gosh, you know, the left is going further on this and this and, you know, the 1984 totalitarian, blah, blah, blah. We're all doomed and it's all over. And linear extrapolations, I think, are always naive and wrong because there are feedback loops. And, you know, as stuff gets crazier, more and more people start saying, I can't buy into this anymore. And I think that we are rapidly approaching that point. The cathedral or the, you know, political organization right now has this plan that has worked for them, and it's worked for 20 or 30 or 40 years, which is you bang more and more about racism, and it motivates the base, and it gets people out to march, and it motivates donations. And, you know, they did this for all 4 years of Trump. And, you know, there's a terrible thing. I mean, it's hilarious, but it's also terrible, which is that the word racist and the word Nazi have lost all power because, you know, racism is a terrible thing and no one wants to be, you know, called a racist if it's meaningful. And Nazis are, you know, the second worst political thing after communism. And, you know, that's terrible and no one wants to be called a Nazi. And so at first they're saying, you know, okay, these literal Nazis marching down the streets are Nazis. And you're like, yes, they are. They're saying terrible things about Jews. You know, that's terrible. And then next they're saying, you know, this guy who's not a Nazi, but he's got some, you know, really bad opinions as a Nazi. You're like, yeah, okay, I guess that's pretty Nazi-like. And then pretty soon, you know, my half-Nigerian friend Fred is being called a Nazi. I'm like, A, he's not a Nazi, and B, that word is now entirely meaningless.
It doesn't matter anymore.
Right, right.
It's not about the word being meaningless. Mm-hmm. The word can mean whatever it wants. I just don't care.
Right. I'm saying. You've done something amazing when half the population doesn't care anymore.
But it's not about half the population. Mm-hmm. It's not half the population. I don't care about what these leftist rage bait smear merchants care for the same reason I don't care about what people in Liberia are saying about me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different country, mm-hmm. and it has nothing to do with me.
Right.
So when I see these people who I know live in Wally World and blah, 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 and believe nonsensical garbage, I'm like, they can say whatever they want. I'm over it.
Yep.
I don't view them as the divide in this country has grown so great.
Right. There's two countries.
That it's beyond two countries.
And there's all these different fractals.
It is beyond two countries. Mm-hmm. It is beyond two countries. When I heard, this is the example I use every time, Joe Biden talking about lockdowns, when red states were doing the opposite, I was like, that's it. It is very clear that he does not view us as part of the conversation, mm-hmm. or as part of the country or as someone who needs to be talked to. So when I see someone in the mainstream media and NBC or whatever say something, I'm like, why do I care what they think?
Yep.
It is not part of the world I live in. And I didn't start it. I'm just responding to it.
Absolutely. My friend Adam said something really interesting a month or two back, which is, you know, I think his exact words were, I'm really realizing more and more that I'm a patriot of a country that never really existed. And I think, you know, if you look at Twitter and other places, people on the right are saying, you know, effectively, I don't know what I believe in. I, you know, believe in this 1950s world, but also that 1950s world was maybe more an artifact of marketing than reality.
Oh, yeah.
And people on the left, you know, they march, but then the world isn't operating the way they think it's supposed to operate and their models are broken. There's a huge cultural malaise or ennui or something going on because all of the old explanations and answers have broken down. And, you know, Joe Biden isn't motivating anyone. There's no narratives that are motivating anyone. And we're discovering the new world right now.
It's true, man. We ended slavery, but China didn't. Mm-hmm. And we buy products from China that are getting made by slaves. So we're basically still supporting slavery.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we have companies that have used sweatshop labor for a long time.
Blatant. Like it is blatant structurally in the economy.
And I'll tell you this, because at Occupy Wall Street, they had a memorial for Steve Jobs. That to me was the funniest thing. Now, it's not like the people of Occupy all came together and voted, here, we all agree. But many people there set up a memorial because he died in October of 2011. And I was laughing at just like the absurdity of one of the most ruthless, cutthroat capitalist businessmen who exploited Chinese communist slave labor is being propped up by these people at Occupy. And I was there and I'm just like, and you know what? I've long known, because I worked in nonprofits, that it's all marketing, it's all PR, it's all an attempt to gain support. But I think what happens is the internet allows for, you know, we used to have 5 TV channels or whatever.
3 if you're older. Yeah.
3, right. Yeah. And everyone just agreed with like the narrative coming from these channels.
Yeah, the Overton window was an inch wide.
That's right. Now with the internet, the Overton window extends for the most part from like the center right to the far left.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hilarious that that's true. The mainstream will allow these conversations. They'll wag their finger at the center right.
Right, right. You're
so
naughty.
And they'll clap for the far left.
Right.
But anyway, the main point is that it allows the entirety of the political compass to exist now in the space, even if we can say the Overton window doesn't include the far right, the authoritarian right, and even, and for some reason, ANCAPs get lumped in there sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Overton window includes just enough Republicans that they the cathedral or they the you know sort of central political organization can say, oh, we're tolerant, we accept everyone up to John McCain, and you know maybe Mitt Romney on a good day.
But regardless of what the cathedral thinks, there are online communities for literally every
absolutely faction. And it's glorious. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be much harder. It was much more centralized, more of a now it's evened out quite a bit. But I do think this is causing a lot of our problems, especially when, you know, so we're seeing this shuffling, this great sorting algorithm is kind of happening. West Virginia is losing residents, right? And one of the stories I read was about a teacher, and she gave an interview and she was like, what they're doing to the unions and how they treat us is absurd and this state is racist, so I'm leaving. I'm going to Austin or something like that, or, you know, some other city. And I'm like, isn't it fascinating that in one of the West Virginia, I think, is the second most Trump supporting state from 2020. And you have the people who are Democrats outraged and leaving. Meanwhile, you have the more conservative types from cities outraged and leaving.
Right.
Everything's being sorted. Yeah. It's almost like we're in this big, you know, sieve or whatever, and it's being, you know, shaking it, and some are falling through and some aren't.
Yeah.
So I wonder, the fascinating thing about this is, you know, I've talked about Civil War quite a bit. And right now, we have this poll showing the potential Balkanization. It's I did the math, 37.2% of the population is in favor of their region Balkanizing.
You know, my dad is a real centrist Republican, you know, sort of Mitt Romney Republican. And I had the pleasure of seeing my folks over this past weekend after a year and a half because of COVID. And my dad, this sort of, you know, mainstream whatever media TV is telling me, you know, he's talking about, you know, we need to break into two countries. And when you're looking at, you know, 75-year-old boomers who came up in the system and they're saying, you know, they're sounding like some crazy neo-reactionary on Twitter. Man, the world's gotten strange.
But it's not neo-reactionary. It's 47% of Democrats on the West Coast.
Yep.
So what we're seeing with this, with separation, is I'm not actually convinced it's going to just be, you know, so one thing I've said recently is that I think we're more likely to break up than see civil war.
Yeah.
But I'll stress, with this great sorting that's happening, it's entirely possible we do see the country split along hard lines.
You know, we're definitely not going to see civil war, because wars happen when you've got a lot of young men, and our population structure will not support a war. You know, there's just not enough cannon fodder. Neal Stephenson, a great science fiction author, one of my favorites, has had the sort of future history of loosely linked books. And he has sort of, you know, crazy red tribe rural areas and crazy blue tribe rural areas, and somehow they coexist. And I think that sometimes governments just get exhausted and don't have the political will to enforce hegemony. And, you know, I think that we're to some degree stepping into that world right now, where we get soft secession, that, you know, maybe the tax dollars keep filing back to Washington, and, you know, maybe the bomber bases still sit here, but we're not going to listen to laws we don't want to. And we've seen that with marijuana legalization at the state level.
What if we end up with multiple layers of governments going on at once? One while the electricity's on, and one if it goes off, and it's like a contingency.
Well, let's be real for a second. What do you think is going to happen to these blue areas when the collapse or the disarray happens, or the you know?
You know, it's a red tribe talking point that, you know, oh, you know, the blue areas, they're all fashion designers and accountants, and there's a totally fake economy there, and these people don't produce anything. Whereas out here in steel and corn country, this is the real world. And, you know, I understand the emotions behind that, that the blue tribe often doesn't see the red tribe virtues. They don't appreciate hard work and diligence and, you know, breaking bones and getting sweaty and all these other things. And so you want to believe that, you know, they're effete losers, bug men living in pods. And my books, by the way, start out, I think there's, you know, on the dedication page that, you know, this is to Robert Heinlein, who taught us not to be bug men living in pods. But the blue areas do huge amounts of useful things, and we're not going to, you know, if there were a civil war, we're not going to surround Boston for a second time and starve them out, because they export intellectual property and they've got a port, and all of the food they ever want to buy is going to come in from the world. So, I'm not predicting a collapse, and I'm not predicting civil war. I think a peaceful divorce would be great, and I think both sides would do okay afterwards.
In a peaceful divorce, it wouldn't be both sides. You know, there's no real way to split the country in two. Mm-hmm. But there could be five regions.
Mm-hmm.
And then there could be a bunch of different regions. Right. You know, where do you know, California produces a massive amount of food mm-hmm. for the country and for the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not convinced that the farmers in Tulare, who are mostly Trump-supporting Republicans, mm-hmm. are going to be like, sure, I'll give my food to these hippie lunatics in the cities.
Right. Well, give or, you know, are subject to regulation by. I mean, if...
Conquered.
Yeah. I don't know that either side really has the manpower to do that. I think that we are going to see, if there is a great divorce, which I don't think is super likely, but I hope we do. If there is a great divorce, I think it's going to
happen. China comes in then.
Well, so that's the other thing. If you look at the U.S. Revolution, the U.S. Revolution only succeeded because there was a great power war going on where right. England didn't have the ability to fight us because they were busy fighting France. And if you look at how the U.S. always plays divide and conquer, we're always backing one faction overseas, you know, this Syrian, you know, rebel group versus the other one. And so, you know, I think China is going to get old before it gets rich. So they are most dangerous for the next 10 or 20 or 30 years. But I don't think that the future of the world is Chinese. But if the U.S. got into severe problems, then absolutely China would be funneling money and weapons.
Yeah, and you would see one faction in the United States side with China yep. to win. That would be crazy, just like the revolution, man.
I look at these regions they've in this poll where it's mm-hmm. like you got the Pacific region, the Heartland, the South, the Northeast.
There was a great book by Joel Guru like 30 years ago called The Nine Nations of North America that I recommend on this topic.
But I think the Northeast might be the most at risk. You know, look, I can look at the Heartland and be like, mm-hmm. there's a lot of corn there.
Mm-hmm.
I can look at the Pacific and be like, California produces a ton of food.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the South and I'm like, also lots of farmland and fertile areas.
The mountains impossible to take.
Northeast,
how could you invade the mountains?
What does the Northeast have? Crabs?
The Northeast has ports. I mean, if you go to Whole Foods in Cambridge, Massachusetts right now, you know, where is that food coming from? I'm sure some of it is coming from Vermont, but a lot of it's coming from Chile or Brazil.
Let's say the Northeast was just, you know, by itself.
Okay.
What does it have to offer for its ports to function?
Lumber?
Crab?
Lumber? A lot of lumber.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that
what is New Hampshire going to get?
What do we export? We've got a lot of rocks. New Hampshire, I think its leading industries are things like, you know, healthcare administration. Ooh. And, I don't want to work in that industry. I'd rather do what I do. But again, this gets to the Red Tribe belief that, like, that's not real work. It's all make work and there's no reason for it to exist. And I'm going to go with sort of a Chesterton fence that, you know, this exists and I assume there's a good reason for it. They're presumably delivering value to someone.
There are many jobs that should not exist but are forced to.
There's a great essay, Bull Jobs, and I don't know if you've seen it. And I think I do agree with that. So I'm not going to contradict myself.
I thought about this for a long time. Insurance salesman. Mm-hmm. No offense if you sell insurance. But, you know, for the most part, people just go online and automatically
right.
get their service. McDonald's, fast food restaurants,
mm-hmm.
they're just replacing people with kiosks.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think is happening is that one thing I've talked about this since I was a teenager, the struggle of capitalism in a technological revolution is, and this is a really obvious for a lot of people, that when you have an industrialization, a lot of jobs get washed away.
Mm-hmm.
But in our current system, we don't just give people stuff. The challenge there is if one person has to work to help the society survive, they will not tolerate very likely if other people are not working and getting equal access to resources.
Right.
So long as there are people who need to make food, giving free food to other people is going to make people angry. In which case, that's one of the biggest challenges we have as we move forward technologically. You'll get people saying, don't take my job away. And then when someone gets their job taken away through no fault of their own, and then you get a government subsidy, then they're like, oh, you're taking my tax dollars to pay them. With this potential breakup or great reset, they will erase all of these jobs. And they are. We see fast food restaurants struggling to hire people. How long until they all just upgrade to kiosks?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Many of them probably will. How about this? I was at a rest station. They had an ice cream box, and it was a little robot man.
Huh.
And I wanted a chocolate sundae with chocolate syrup and sprinkles. And the little robot man just goes meh, 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 and then hands me the little thing. We don't need a human being to do it anymore. So this great reset, I imagine, is going to purge a ton of jobs.
To go off on a tangent about this job loss, you know, the libertarian or free market answer is, you know, actually automation in steel mills is great because it used to take 100 blacksmiths to do something. And you're sure you're upset that 99% of them are unemployed, but they're now going to get new jobs as machinists. And, you know, as we get rid of the sort of...
But that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who was mining coal can't learn to code.
Right. And so I agree with you. Yeah. And that's where I'm going with this thesis. It was true to some decent degree that as certain jobs went away, there were always more jobs that were brought in. But we're getting to a point where we can automate any job that requires less than a 70 IQ and then an 80 IQ and a 90 IQ. And, you know, someone who happens to be born with a 90 IQ, that's no deficit of character. That's just how it is. And he's equally a human being as anyone else. But you start to get to a problem when we can automate anything under a 90 or a 95 or 100 or 105 IQ. And I do worry that we're getting to that world. Now, you were talking about the anger against welfare, and there is a fair bit of anger. But on the other hand, we have, as a society, a rhetorical device, or several rhetorical devices. We have welfare for the old called Social Security, and the polite fiction is you paid into that. And you did, but you end up taking a lot more out of it than you put in. And we have another polite fiction, which is disability. And the fiction there is you can't work, so a decent society helps you. And there are some people who are truly disabled. There was a good article in The Atlantic, I don't know, like 2 or 3 years ago, talking about how disability is kind of a different form of welfare, where if you go to the right doctor and say the right things, where there are unfalsifiable statements like, my back hurts, then you get it. And so, you know, all societies have white lies they tell themselves, and I wonder if disability is ours to deal with the fact that cognitive things are being priced out.
Let's think about that in the context of the Great Reset or a great divorce within this country. How will people in cities get access to food from farmers if right now what we're seeing is they're doing this unemployment thing. They've been doing it nonstop. They're doing child tax credits now. So a lot of people who aren't working are getting money. That means for the farmer who's growing corn or wheat or whatever and they go to sell it, they do a lot of work. They have to.
Yep.
You can't just snap your fingers and make that stuff.
It's hard work.
But the people,
you don't just poke a hole in the ground and drop a seed in. It was Como or something?
Right. The people in the cities, they're handed money and they walk to you and they get your labor effectively for free.
Right.
I can't imagine that's sustainable.
Yeah.
The only way that actually keeps sustaining itself is that the people doing the work don't know that people who aren't doing work are you know, as long as they don't know that's happening, but they do know it's happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can only imagine, you know, going back to that, as you mentioned, the what did you call it? A red state belief or the?
Yeah. Red state, red tribe.
Red tribe belief. I'll tell you this, man. I know a lot of people live in cities. You put them in the middle of the woods, it's over.
So this ties into a prepping thing where, you know, I sometimes flip through prepping magazines when I'm at the bookstore having a coffee, which I do, you know, once a week or so. Or, you know, someone will forward me something off of a prepping forum. And people like this idea that, oh, I'm going to buy a can of survival seeds. Or my plan when the system collapses, I'm going to bug out and I'm going to find an abandoned farm and I'll just start farming. And, you know, speaking of my own experience, my wife and I have been on the farm for about 8 years and we have been working, you know, hugely hard, you know, on the order of, you know, all of Saturday, all of Sunday, weeding and chainsawing down trees and converting pasture and stretching fences. And we've also brought in pros to help us with some of this, like, you know, fencing and other stuff. And there's so much equipment and there's so much specialized knowledge, which is why the books are so thick, where, you know, I learned that, you know, oh, in this pasture, I want to grow hay so that I can feed sheep, so that I can get food from that. But before I can grow hay, I've got to kill off the poison ivy, which means that I need to put down 2,4-D and 360 at a certain application rate.
And just to
finish real quickly, the idea that you're going to wander out with a can of survival seeds as civilization is collapsing and, you know, feed yourself is absolutely insane. Homesteading is a viable approach, but, you know, it's a 10-year plan.
What's the, tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
How long out of the year do you get viable tomatoes?
Right, absolutely. So, you know, if you plant all of your tomatoes at once, all of your tomato harvest is going to come in over a course of 2 weeks. Now,
That's
you can stagger
fun.
That by planting tomatoes week one, week two, week three in different batches. But even then, your tomatoes are going to be very, you know, short interval. And there's not a lot of calories in tomatoes. So, you know, again, getting to survival scenario, this is fine. You know, homesteading is a hobby and a lifestyle, and I'll defend it as that, but it's not you know, a way to survive the apocalypse with no inputs. There's a huge amount of inputs of diesel fuel and fertilizer and other stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah. We have our tomatoes. I would say that we had four standard tomato plants and one cherry tomato. The cherry tomatoes, easy. I walk outside, we pick them all. We walk in, they're good to go. The regular tomatoes, extremely difficult. The bugs get them.
Yep.
And they a lot of rot. Some of them turns black.
You know, and there's all sorts of details. Like if you want to save the seeds from tomatoes, tomatoes are tricky because there is a sort of gel-like coating on the seeds and you have to let the seeds sit in the gel and rot for a week or two and then wash them off and then preserve the seeds. And this is another thing that, you know, if you don't know this stuff, you're just going to make an absolute hash of it.
Yeah. So, we have a garden, and the funny thing is we get like baseball bat size zucchini.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of the past 2 weeks, it's like, we can't eat all this.
Mm-hmm.
Like we set up a garden, but we grew a whole bunch. All the tomatoes come around the same time.
Yep.
And then we're like, what are we going to do?
Right.
Make a sauce, I guess?
You know, preservation technology is huge. And yes. There's a whole lot of flavors that we as humans like because we sort of evolved in a semi-civilized state. We love smoked beef jerky.
Yeah.
Because that's a preservation technology. We like pickles because that's a preservation technology. We like cheese because that's a preservation technology. And my hint with the zucchini, by the way, I peel my zucchini, I shred them in a food processor, I vacuum seal them, I throw them in a chest freezer. And then I mix that with ground turkey and onions and make turkey fritters.
Amazing.
All year long.
Now, what's fascinating, though, is that a lot of what you're describing is that we got modern technology like freezers and refrigerators.
Uh-huh.
So I'll tell you this, man. Where we are right now, we are this facility is going to be, for the most part, off the grid.
Nice.
Meaning our water is well water.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting solar and batteries installed.
Nice.
We're still on the grid.
Yep.
But in the event of an absolute catastrophe.
Yep.
We're going to be able to be fine. We'll have to reduce a lot of our energy consumption, mm-hmm. but actually, we'll have a decent amount of power. These batteries are hefty, man.
Yep. I carried like 4,000 pounds of lead acid batteries down to my basement to build my system, so I know all about it. Yeah, they are hefty.
Well, I think we're going to have lithium.
Nice.
I'm not entirely sure.
I put mine in around 7 or 8 years ago, and I'm going to, I'm building out the solar right now, and the second battery bank is going to be lithium, so
but
great.
Let's be real, man. Like, people in cities stacked on top of each other? They're not going to have any of this. The
power
is going to go out, and the food's going to be gone. I was in New York when Sandy hit,
mm-hmm.
and there were two guys standing outside of a bodega with 2x4s and a baseball bat, one person at a time. And the guy said all the refrigerator stuff is spoiled
because
the power was out for a couple weeks.
I think.
They were like, the cans are good, everything else is spoiled.
Mm-hmm.
So take what you want.
Roof Korean's awesome.
Yeah, Mountain Dew was fine. You know, all the sodas mm-hmm. were fine, but anything perishable gone.
So
your freezers, all that stuff in the city.
Yeah.
Over.
Right. And
what are those people going to do?
Yeah. No, they are absolutely screwed. And
you're going to find them on your farm.
Well, I do have a chapter on firearms.
Well, there you go.
Right. This ties back to the idea of prepping and the power law, which is the title of one of the essays. I think it's in volume two, where, how often does New York City lose power, for a week or something? It happened, I think, back in 76 or 78 or something.
Hurricane Sandy.
And Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of thing, it seems inconceivable, but you pull back and zoom out, and you're like, no, this crap happens every 30 or 40 years, and you're going to live another 30 or 40 years. You're going to see it happen again. You're going to see all these things happen in your lifetime.
This is the craziest thing to me about when I was like, last year, I'm like, hey, guys, pick up these, food bins. Mm-hmm. I got to say, it was mostly these young people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these lefties. These socialists are young.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the worldly experience to have dealt with these things.
Mm-hmm.
Having seen Hurricane Sandy,
yep.
I was like, wow, it would be great if I had one of those food bins. So I remember when I was living in New York, and there, I can't remember what was happening. There was some concern about another storm. I went and bought two things of bottled water. I was mm-hmm. like, that's going to be important.
Yep.
They tell you in Chicago, whenever they say there's a big storm coming, you fill up your bathtub.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
you know, if the water goes bad, if lines break, if some disaster happens, you got a bunch of water in your bathtub.
Yep.
That's the kind of thing people who are older, I guess, learn.
Mm-hmm.
Younger people don't. But still, there is like this arrogance of many people live in cities. Like you said, they think they can grab a can of seeds and go find a farm
right,
somewhere.
Right.
I tell you, man, in the what did Noam Chomsky say? In the arena of violence, the most brutal guy wins, and that ain't us. And he was mm-hmm. referring to leftists.
Right, right.
These people think that they're going to go out to a farm where they're going to find a guy who's been using a gun, a firearm, or multiple ones for practical purposes, be it hunting or dealing with rodents and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be able to walk on and just lay claim
right.
to a already built up and secured and maintained farm.
Fertilizer.
Yeah.
That's what they're going to be, is fertilizer.
Right.
I don't know if humans can be fertilizer. That's kind of,
I don't know.
I've got a chapter of composting.
Oh, jeez.
Well, we hope it doesn't come to that, honestly.
Right. A
lot of hungry people, though.
So there's another thing that I hear in prepping circles, and it's a feel-good phrase. It's not the equipment that you have that matters. It's what you know that matters. Because, equipment can be taken from you, but what you know is a resource.
Yeah.
And, if there's some guy living in a basement, in Brooklyn, and he's been reading survival forms for 6 years, and then the system collapses, and he comes out to my farm and wants to share his knowledge with me for food, I don't need any knowledge that this guy, learned from endlessly recycled blog posts. you know, there's, oh gosh, there's some ancient Greek words for different kinds of knowledge, techne and metis or something. But to really, really know something, you've got to do it, and you've got to do it ahead of time. And you're absolutely doing this with your tomatoes and your chicken. So if you lost power, you've already practiced it. So that's real knowledge. It's not something you've just
we got a couple mulberry trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so we made mulberry jam.
Nice.
We made we mixed wineberry and mulberry, yep. like a wild berry. That was actually really, I'm not a big fan of mulberries.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but, I love them, but okay.
But when I mix them with the wineberries, yep. it was really good. And the wineberries alone, I think the combination, but anyway, digress. Do you know how many calories, you probably do, are in 10 mulberries?
I'm guessing that it rounds to zero, like 10.
Six.
Okay. All right.
Six. Yeah. Ian nailed it last time.
Damn,
he was like
man.
Six. I'm like, nice. How did you know that? But, 10.
Uh-huh.
Wow. That's a small handful of berries you're going to mm-hmm. shove in your mouth. 6 calories.
Right.
You will not, there's no amount of mulberry you're going to eat to sustain yourself for even a few hours.
Right.
And so, you know, naturally occurring fruits and stuff, people don't realize. I'll tell you this story. And this plays into exactly what I'm saying. I had friends during Occupy Wall Street. Got granted farmland.
Mm-hmm.
How long do you think, let me ask you, how long do you think they last, that they made it?
So they went out there and tried to start farming
said,
from scratch?
They said, we don't want to be on the grid. We're tired of contributing to this machine of pollution and climate change. So we're going to the farm to live sustainably.
3 days a week?
2 weeks.
Okay,
2 weeks.
Well.
You know, I'm impressed. Most people say like a couple months.
No.
A few days. You didn't even give them the benefit of the doubt. 2 weeks.
Okay.
You know what they realized?
Mm-hmm.
I asked my friend. She was like, I was like, why'd you come back?
Mm-hmm.
She was like, because I'd wake up at 6 a.m. to work, go to bed at midnight.
Yep.
And I'm like, yeah. What did you think farming was? When you are actually trying to sustain yourself, you never stop working.
Right, right. And this gets into, you know, people have said, you know, to me, oh, you know, if we had a collapse, I bet you'd love it. You know, and like, no, man. Right now, it's a very, very hard hobby that I do on the weekends with lots of diesel fuel coming in
yeah.
from outside. If that diesel fuel went away and, you know, I tried to make a producer gas still using old FEMA plans and started logging trees to make producer gas to do stuff, you know, it's better than starving to death, but that's hard
work. But you know what I did this morning?
Mm-hmm.
I went out and I grabbed some fresh jalapenos
mm-hmm.
and a poblano and some cherry tomatoes. And then I went to the chicken coop and I got a couple of eggs. And mm-hmm. so one of our chickens is, I guess she's young, so she's doing double eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're yep. twice as big. They're massive.
Right.
And I would say, to be fair, 99% of my breakfast was completely homegrown.
Yeah.
But I threw in some garlic powder.
And people like to say, you know, and it's so much healthier. I'm not sure it is healthier, but man, it's so much more satisfying, isn't it? That's just amazing. We're like, this all came from here.
You know, to be honest, I'm not a big fan of like throwing peppers mm-hmm. in egg. Like if I went to a restaurant, I'd be like, give me the bacon and the eggs with mm-hmm. extra cheese on top. But today I had cherry tomatoes with fresh cut jalapenos, poblano on eggs, and it tasted so good.
Nice, nice. You know, that is one of the most satisfying things. And we've done all sorts of stuff. You know, we've made corn fritters. We've, made maple, syrup creme brulee from maple trees that we've tapped and I boil down the sap and make my own maple syrup. I push back on homesteaders who say everything tastes better. Like, no, you know, some food at, you know, Whole Foods and the supermarkets tastes really good. The one thing that, comes from the farm that's just absolutely amazing is homemade bacon. And, you know, I'm not going to say it's 10% better, it's 20% better. Homemade bacon is like literally 10 times better. Like, you just don't want store-made stuff.
We got farms around here.
Uh huh.
And so we have gotten fresh bacon.
Nice, nice.
And it is indescribable.
Yeah.
Right, like, I don't even want the store-bought stuff.
Right, right.
It's not the same.
Yeah, it's a pale imitation. It's like turkey bacon or something.
It's like turkey bacon.
Yeah. And if I can plug my own book again,
oh, yeah.
I've got tons of details on how to make your own bacon from scratch. And you can do it even living on the suburbs. I started
from
making
scratch?
My own.
Is it just take pig, cut
well,
pig?
It does, yeah. I mean, the ingredients say, you know, you need, you know, salt, man. And you need, and you need pig. And, you know, for pig, see page 458. But you can practice a bunch of this stuff living in the suburbs. You can buy a whole pork belly from the butcher and do it at home.
Do you think people who live in cities should escape the cities right now?
You know, so one of the things I've got in the intro chapter is, you know, here's a 1 year plan. You're ready to move. What do you need to do? Here's a 3 year plan. And one of the things I have is a 10 year plan for young adults, because I've had a lot of, you know, friends on Twitter who are 22 or 26 ask me. And, you know, I've said on the 10-year plan, don't move right this second. You know, the cities aren't about to collapse tomorrow. What you need to do is learn a skill. You need to learn some stuff. And you need to find your mate. It's a lot easier to meet people in the city than it is out in the middle of nowhere.
So you don't think, I think people should be getting away from cities immediately.
Okay. Well, that's going to help me sell the book. So I agree, Tim. I've never heard an idea that's so right.
with, you know, you look at how the law is being enforced.
Uh-huh.
It's been referred to, I know Mike Cernovich tweeted about this. I think, maybe Michael Malice may have mentioned it, anarcho-tyranny.
Absolutely. And those are two good followers. I follow both those guys as well.
For those that aren't familiar, anarcho-tyranny is basically that the government doesn't enforce the crimes and petty things that are negatively impacting your life. You're being robbed. But they do enforce anything that goes against them in any way, or the powerful elites.
Yeah, so and absolutely that's arson during riots. Well, that's just a bit of vibrant democracy. You know that went 2% too far.
Peaceful.
But on the other hand, you know, some white collar guy has a pistol that isn't known to the attorney general to have all 17 of the checkpoints, and he gets dragged through the system, and he's lucky if he gets off without jail time after he spent $100,000 on legal fees.
I see this as being for the most part where we are.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that, Joe Biden clearly isn't speaking to half the country,
mm-hmm.
and that's a failure on his part. I mean, you look at what Jen Psaki issued, one of the most shocking statements, when she said that they were working with Facebook to censor people.
Oh, my God, that
was
horrifying.
When the Biden administration is now admitting that they're working with the DNC to go to phone carriers to censor private text messages, it is mm-hmm. anarcho-tyranny.
Yeah.
There are riots in the streets. The crime is skyrocketing. The police are being defunded.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the government is coming after private citizens
yep.
to an extreme degree.
There was a great quote. I think it was from P.J. O'Rourke. I read it 10 or 20 years ago, which is that PETA goes after women wearing fur coats and not bikers wearing leather jackets. And I think that's part of the explanation behind anarcho-tyranny. I mentioned earlier that I studied Roman history. And one thing in the later days of the empire, the Roman political elite wanted triumphs, which was a big parade through downtown Rome because it looked great and you'd have treasure. And the problem is that to conquer a tough foreign tribe is hard, and there's not many of them, they're far away. So at some point, the Roman political elites started waging war against allies and their own provinces because it was a way to, kill a bunch of people and take some treasure.
Yeah.
And so this ties into anarcho-tyranny. Who's easier to prosecute? Sort of, high-ranking, corruption, or just pick a random white-collar guy?
I'm at this point, sick of people who are the frog in the pot boiling,
mm-hmm.
who refuse to accept what is happening around them, because I've had so many conversations where I'm like, listen, I'm not trying to be a doomsayer.
Mm-hmm.
I am not absolutely predicting what will happen. I'm mm-hmm. only simply asking, if everything we've seen over the past 10 years mm-hmm. has been escalating,
yep.
do you think it is more likely that the escalation will continue, or that right now the escalation will stop and things will improve?
Right. That's a great way to frame it.
But quite literally, tomorrow, Joe Biden could come out and say, I want to issue a heartfelt, sincere apology to all of Trump's supporters for everything that's happened in this country. And I want to know that I am here for you
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to be sitting down. And, he could say something. He won't.
Right.
What does he say? He says the Republicans voting bills is the greatest threat since the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
No one is backing down.
And no one will stop. This gets into the rhetoric where Nazi and racist are the ultimate Trump cards. The Civil War. So this is implicitly putting anyone who doesn't agree with, sort of every policy of the Democratic Party is obviously on the side of bringing back slavery.
Civil War. He's saying it at mm-hmm. a time when we have this poll coming out, whether the poll is accurate or not, and the sentiment is rising for a breakup of this country.
Mm-hmm.
I can only say that a president who would say that is encouraging, and he's an accelerationist.
Yep.
He wants it to happen. Now, I can say this over and over again. I do not want anything bad to happen to this country, and mm-hmm. I think the divide is horrifying because of what will happen with our enemies.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing I want is for China to take Taiwan. Now, no chips for computers and cars. And China controls that. They gain more control in all of these other regions as they are expanding with the Belt and Road Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
We need a strong United America.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Biden, I think, is doing everything to rip it apart.
Mm-hmm. There was an essay I read once. I think it was by this guy, Clark Hatt, on Status 451 blog, talking about the machinery of state and state machines. And the idea is that there are things that can roll forward, but that can't roll back the same way. And you can see it in mechanical engineering with worm gears and everything. And I'm not sure what the output of this is. I mean, accelerationism and the collapse of the United States sounds terrible. But if we were in the kind of system where we could back up, we would have already backed up. So I don't know how we get out of this.
I have talked to so many people, and I mention this frequently, particularly in the past week or so with this poll that came out, Talk of Thucydides Trap, the MIT study that came. You saw that MIT thing?
I did not.
1972, MIT said, was it MIT? It was MIT, right?
I don't know.
Oh, this tied into the Korolev waves, and I think
they said by 2040, society will collapse due to these factors and everything like that. And I'm looking at all these things. I'm looking at a vice president who's saying this is the biggest threat since the Civil War. And he said the Confederates never made it to the Capitol. And I'm like, wow, dude, you're saying these Trump supporters, there were hundreds of thousands of people who didn't go in the Capitol. Mm-hmm. You're likening Trump's base to the Confederates. How could that not be accelerationism? But I see this. I've seen so many people over the past several years tell me I was wrong or crazy to think that we're headed towards some kind of civil conflict. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, bro, we're in it.
Yeah.
We are in it. And you know, how could we have come to this point? I had a conversation recently with someone who was like, nah, everything's going to be fine. It's going to calm down. We're all going to go back to normal. And I'm like, why? Because Trump's going to decide not to run? Because Trump's going to just disappear overnight? Mm-hmm. Or do you think 2022, Trump's going to be doing the circuit, promoting people in the midterms? The media is going to find their path towards making money again. And so that doesn't matter what's true or not. Mm-hmm. They're going to go, they're absolutely insane, rile people up to an extreme degree. And then we're going to have 3 years of that. And you think it's going to be all fine?
You know, I think, so I'm agreeing with your overall thesis, but I think even if Trump dropped dead from a heart attack tomorrow, the two tribes have been led to hate each other so much. And this is, you know, fuel. The media loves it. The Democrats love it. And because it gets excitement, it gets people out to the polls, it gets donations. The New York Times loves it. I mean, the New York Times has been hugely more profitable over the last few years than it ever was before. And so,
The ACLU is the perfect example.
Oh, God. You know, they used to be wonderful. I mean, I lean more to the right than to the left, but I always loved the ACLU as, man, they stick by their principles. And even I, who disagree with most of the members of it, on free speech, they rock.
But what happened was they made a bunch of money when they challenged Donald Trump's moratorium on travel from those seven countries. And then they got a bunch of flack over Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. And so they immediately said, money's more important than values.
Yep.
And we've seen that with many different organizations. That's
the universities. I mean, there used to be the concept of academic freedom where, okay, this one professor with his crazy ideas, you know, disagrees with all decent society, but we respect free speech and free inquiry so much that we will support him in this. And, you know, that was a useful tool until the left could entirely finish their long march through the institutions. But now that they've got it, there's no academic freedom at all. If you want to say anything that departs from the party line by 2%, you can get fired.
I look at these nonprofits, and I look at the media, and I'm just like, I don't think there's a point at which the two different versions of reality ever meet.
Mm-hmm.
So I love calling this organization freepress.net. You ever hear of them?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think they're supposed to be representing?
From the title, I would think the Free Press.
Now, would you be surprised to find out they were advocating censorship?
I would not be surprised.
That's exactly what they've been
doing. It's 1984, man.
Yep. They came out heavily against Alex Jones, saying he must be censored and banned and removed. And I knew people there. Mm-hmm. And I hit them up and I was like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, this is important. You know, he spreads lies. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you're the Free Press. Of course you're going to defend people who will say bad things.
So
you have to.
There's this current push right now to get rid of misinformation. And I'm reading a book. I was reading it on the airplane about the Soviets, how they almost invented the internet. And they had a couple of networking attempts in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And they had the whole concept of, you know, cybernetics, which came from the U.S. and then the Soviets were playing with it. And there was one part of cybernetics and information theory and Claude Shannon and everything that immediately had resonance with them. And that was static or noise in the system because it fit into their ideology. You could talk about information on the one hand and noise on the other. And that was chilling to read this in the book about the Soviet internet attempts of the 1970s, because we're hearing it every day with, oh, of course we have free speech, but not for misinformation. And like, oh, man.
And did you see what was it NPR said? That the truth with not proper context is misinformation?
Wonderful.
So what's proper context?
Right.
Framing?
Yep.
So when The Guardian comes out with an article that says the Kremlin seems to have compromise on Trump, or according to a document, and then all of these people in the establishment left just read the headline and don't actually read the story.
Right.
They believe that we have the proof that Trump is compromised. I mean, then you read the actual story. What do they say? It's highly unusual, suspect. The Kremlin denies it. Trump denies it. And we haven't confirmed any of the documents. But experts think it may be real.
Right.
Okay, so none of it's confirmed. Why did you publish it? But if you read nothing but the headline, there you go. It's proof.
You know, Snopes.com is amazing these days because we'll have a politician say, you know, the sun rises in the east. And, you know, and then Snopes will say, you know, this is absolutely false without more context because actually the earth is rotating and the sun stands still. And like, oh, man.
Well, the way I always describe it to people is that what they'll do is, there'll be a video of Donald Trump doing a backflip off of, you know, a balcony and landing perfectly in a superhero pose. Everyone will share the video and it'll go viral. It'll get 10 million views and every conservative will say, wow, this Trump is spry, you know, for a 77-year-old man. And then Snopes will say, did Donald Trump do a perfect backflip off of a balcony and land in a superhero pose? on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then they'll say false.
Yep.
Then it'll give you a bunch of exposition garbage. Mm-hmm. And like on Saturday, you know, the 15th, Donald Trump was giving a speech. Yeah. And then finally,
Trump, a known liar.
So, finally, yeah. Exactly. Without evidence, had made these claims. And finally at the bottom, after 500-600 words, it'll say, while Trump did do a perfect backflip and he did land in a superhero pose, it was on Sunday. It was on Monday at midnight,
right.
Which is not Sunday.
Right. Which in Eastern time zone is not Sunday. Yeah.
Exactly. That's the game they
I've
play.
Been thinking about how we were talking earlier about how it's not a linear. We're talking about the accelerationism, mm-hmm. essentially. And it's not linear. It's kind of like a J curve,
right,
which
right.
makes me think of that it's the beginning of an amplification wave that may come back down. So maybe it's not going to keep going. Maybe,
you know, every exponential curve is an S curve once you get to the end of it.
And so yeah. what causes it to amplify greater is coherent interference. We've mm-hmm. got like all this fake news mm-hmm. saying the same stuff, creating this amplification wave. If we create some sort of decoherent interference, mm-hmm. Maybe we can reduce the amplification and slow the acceleration.
It seems plausible. You know, I tend to, I've gotten sort of apolitical or post-political or something over the last couple of years, not because I don't think politics matters. You know, this is fascinating stuff, and I love to sit here and analyze it, and I love to, you know, sort of go back and read old books and see what, you know, correlations we can get. But I think these systems are huger. And by systems, I mean sort of, you know, I'm pro-free market, but capitalism at this point is this massive, you know, sort of headless monster with 7 billion people in it. And, you know, capitalism is going to do what it's going to do. It's like evolution. You know, you get perfect sharks. You may or may not want a shark, but it doesn't matter. And, yeah. you know, you get the perfect Facebook. You get the perfect, yep. You know, et cetera. And you get the perfect Democratic Party. And you get the perfect Republican Party. So
it's only a matter of time. You get the perfect movies.
Yeah.
Movies have whittled down to the lowest common denominator yep. of giant robots blowing stuff up.
Yeah. Yep.
It used to be like Groundhog Day, you know?
Yeah.
It's going to
yeah.
be perfect, but, like you're like,
and
I
so
saw it.
My response to this is mostly to just pull back and disconnect. And so, you know, I've got my friends. I've got, you know, good old books that I read. Yeah.
I think this is the decoherent interference.
Yeah.
Talking about things that aren't in that narrative is creating a decoherence, which is reducing the amplification.
Yeah.
Well, let's take Super Chats and see what the audience has to say. If you haven't already, give that like button a nice little tap. Subscribe to this channel. Leave us a good review on those podcasts. And go to TimCast.com. Become a member for the Members Podcast, which comes up around 11 p.m. every night. And that's usually where we talk about the things that YouTube bans you for. But we'll see. Sometimes we're just chilling fun. Let's see what we got. All right. I don't think I can read your name, Anna. We'll just say Anna. No one cares about France or Australia. American freedom is dying. Everything else is irrelevant. Well, you need to understand that France and Australia could serve as a canary in the coal mine. Mm. France is a nation that is very rebellious, to say the least. And they're also having extremely draconian laws. Australia is, you know, a British Commonwealth, not too dissimilar from the United States in certain ways, but they don't have a Bill of Rights. So we can thank our lucky stars when we see these countries and the bad things that happen. Ireland passed a vaccine passport stuff recently. So the Bill of Rights, thank your lucky stars. But I don't know how much longer it's going to keep protecting us. All right, let's see. Oh, what's this? David Quesada says Tony Hawk came out of retirement and you're not a real skater if you don't talk about it. Well, good for Tony. He is one of the best skateboarders ever, simply by, well, vert skating for sure. His skating street was always funny because he's like he's a vert skater guy. But he's a legend. I mean, he invented so much of skateboarding. However, I think at his current age, I don't see him competing with like Guy Curry, who just did a 1080 for the first time in a competition. 12-year-old kid. 12.
Wow. Tony Hawk's 12. Twitter game is pretty good. I like him.
Tony Hawk's Twitter game consists of him not being recognized by people.
I wonder what Tony Hawk is doing right now. This.
Yeah. Right. I do love it where they're like, hey, your name's Tony. He's like, yep, like that skateboarder, Tony Hawk. Is it? That's right. I love those tweets. They're hilarious.
Absolutely.
He discovered that he's famous, but no one knows what he looks like. No, some people do. All right. Hayden says, Travis, great to have you. I just bought 40 acres of mountain forest land, and I'm realizing I will need to clear dozens of 40-foot trees to build and have a garden.
Awesome.
Do you have advice for starting with totally raw land 20 miles from town? Now, real quick, I also have about an acre with tons of trees on it, and your advice on how to deal with it.
You know, I don't want to sound too much like a shill, but I've got an entire chapter on exactly that. You start with a forest and you want pasture there. What are the, like, 17 steps? And the short version is you're going to log those trees. You're probably going to have an excavator come in to pull out the stumps. Then you're going to do a soil test. You're going to amend the soil as necessary. And there's a lot more, but it's absolutely doable.
But that's not doable by well, for the most part, we're talking about modern technology mm-hmm. in a functioning economy
yeah.
to make this happen.
So, you know, the way that this was classically done in colonial America is that you would debark the trees and then they would die and then you could farm in between them. And you could even log as you got time. You know, people tend to log in the winter. That's when I do my logging because it's a lot easier to skid the logs out to my firewood pile using my tractor on top of snow because it, you know, sort of lubricates and it also protects
the pasture. And it's easier to see, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you don't have to deal with all of the leaves on the trees. You know, you can do this all at once by, you know, throwing a lot of money at it, or you can make it a 10-year project, and there's tons of good firewood there. There's a rule of thumb that you can pull 1 cord of firewood out of 1 acre of forest per year sustainably forever. There's that. But also, if you want to log it all at once, there's a huge amount of firewood there. You can also call in a logger. He might do it for you, but he might want 2/3 or 3/4 of the wood. And that's all covered. It's a huge topic, and it's fascinating. I love talking about forestry and logging, and I love doing it.
Cool, cool. JM says, hey, Ian, I was just thinking about the time I was in a drug-induced coma. I'm pretty sure I saw interdimensional beings. What do you think?
Totally possible. You ever take psychedelics?
I have been fascinated. I never have. But, man, I'd like to meet the machine elves someday.
Yeah.
All right. Rola Koala says, down with communism. We as a nation need less screen time and more community. Service guarantees citizenship. Oh, Ian, down with the Fed. We need more community. You know, John Stewart said it. And I, mm-hmm. and the reason I cite John Stewart is because that should be a message to the left. He, come on, you like this guy, right? Well, he yep. was like, he actually said we needed a draft of some sort.
I've got a problem with that. You know, I think that people confuse, sort of good things that come from terrible things with an overall benefit from it. So, you know, you get drafted for a very good cause, which is, you know, fascism is terrible and putting people in death camps is terrible. And then you make a lot of, you know, lifelong buddies and whatever. But right now, most of the wars we're fighting are absolutely idiotic. And it's always, people who wouldn't be subject to the draft who think that other people need to be drafted.
But
I don't believe in slavery.
He wasn't
like
saying military draft. He was saying some kind of community, like...
I don't want to be drafted to be a social worker, and I wouldn't want anyone else to be drafted for it either.
There is, you know, I thought about this. The challenge is that you end up with a bunch of entitled people, and there's a balance. It's not so simple, I guess. The libertarian aspect of it is leave me alone, let me do my mm-hmm. thing, which is where I usually land on, you know, when it comes mm-hmm. to that dividing line. But I also recognize that without a shared community space, is what I was saying earlier.
I do agree with this, yeah.
If people are online and, like, you know, I'm talking only to, you know, more libertarian types, mm-hmm. but then my neighbors are going to socialists, conflicts are brewing because we live next to each
yep,
other.
Yep.
You know, so there's got to be some kind of culture. You know,
I do agree cohesion. That shared culture is good. I also think that shared experiences coming out of voluntary behavior are much better. And one final thing on this idea of some sort of civil draft. Think about all of the programs and the way they're actually run, no matter how great the theory is, the schools, the DMV. Think about how it's actually implemented. And so if we had some sort of social draft, you know that the children of the rich and wealthy would end up being drafted to work in policy think tanks in D.C. with wonderful apartments. And you know that the children of coal miners yes. would be picking up
cannon
garbage
fodder.
On the side of the road.
Captain says, I have a cabin in northern AZ and want to homestead there permanently, but I work in IT and need internet. I have been on the Starlink waiting list for over a year now. I believe the Starlink is moving from the East Coast towards the West Coast. I could be wrong. It's just because I know I met somebody who has got a New York Starlink, and they said that this area is going to get it near the late 2021, they said. So I think they're activating satellite groups, you know, moving in a direction. But I don't know for sure. I will tell you, Starlink's amazing.
Absolutely.
When it activates, it works within a 500-mile radius. So my understanding is they want you to keep it in the same place, but as long as you're within that range.
Whoa.
So we could drive, like, you know, half an hour up to the top of a mountain.
Yeah.
And
you know, that's all sort of policy because the satellites are continuously orbiting past, so you're getting handed off, you know, time and again.
Right.
You know, I think that Starlink is accelerating in its deployment, so I think wait a little bit longer, but that's great.
All right. Seth says, if you ever wondered why there's dumb failure politicians in office, it's because these people are highly sought after for government because they will say or do whatever they're told, no matter how absurd.
Yeah, this gets back to evolution. I mean, you know, they are we breed politicians according to selection criteria, and the selection criteria is electability. And, you know, when everyone has the franchise, that means that the median voter is pretty dumb and pretty uninformed.
All right. Let's see. Hulk Mash says, hey, guys, excuse me. First of all, this is my favorite podcast out there. Well, thank you very much. Also, I use clips of the show for my TikTok, And one of the videos got over 1 million views. If you ever want to back up TikTok, it's all yours. Oh, wow. Cool. Our TikTok got briefly taken down. No idea why. They just deleted all the videos. And I laughed. I'm like, whatever, man. And then I tweeted about it. And then it popped right back up. But I'm proud to say that TimCast.com, we are officially self-sustainable. There was a big fear for a while that, like, you know, we're beholden to all these different platforms. And then if we got banned, oh, no, it's like we can't work. What do we do? So I was like, we got to start a website. We started a website, and now the new website is up. We've got a news crew. Everything that's currently happening with our news writers and our new show and our current level is sustainable just off of the website alone.
That's amazing.
So the YouTube, all of the stuff we're doing out is like our path towards rapid expansion. So Daily Wire can sit there and get smear pieces from NPR because they're expanding so rapidly. Don't worry, Daily Wire. We're coming for you. We're going to be expanding. Much congratulations on the success of Daily Wire.
I can't wait for our NPR smear piece.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be great.
Fun.
But
you'll know you've made
it. We were just talking with a particular individual about doing field reporting and journalism. I'll refrain from saying who, I guess, but people might already know. And we're going to be launching a bunch of different shows, like cultural shows. So I'm extremely excited for this. TikTok can ban us. I don't even care anymore. I'm just like, whatever, dude.
Yeah.
Eric Cecil says, Kyle Kashif is David Hogg driving the speed limit. Okay. I think there needs more context there to understand what Kyle did, you know. But all right. I think, you know, I've been saying this for a long time. The right needs to be advocating for, like, guaranteed gun access. You know, I'm a big fan of the idea that universal gun ownership, like the government should have to pay for people to have a gun.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Everybody. Yeah, and you know, the argument is, so long as, you know, these left says that healthcare is a human right,
mm-hmm.
and that the government should provide everyone with healthcare, I'm like, hey, hold on. I'm down. But I think then everybody should have to get a gun from the government.
You know, the right has been sort of overly libertarian in a certain way, where the left uses the machinery of the state to indoctrinate and sort of set the playing field. And I think that one thing that Trump has started and that other Republicans are seeing is, hey, if we manage to grab the reins of power for 2 or 4 or 6 years, we shouldn't just, you know, pause the expansion of the state and pause the success of the culture war from one side. We could do something with it. And it's going to be really interesting to see that play out.
You know what's crazy is that there are reins of power at all. I mean, maybe is that in the inevitable superstructure of the universe,
mm-hmm.
that there are reins of power? Do there have to be?
Meritocracy exists. Whether the communists want to believe it or not, it is a real thing.
But
so look, during Occupy Wall Street, they kept saying, we have no leaders. And I was like, they're standing right there. I can see them. They're the ones talking to the camera.
Uh-huh.
Well, but they're not really leaders. Yes, but whatever they say, you do.
Mm-hmm.
You can say they're not formally leaders, but they're clearly the ones who control all the money, who determine when you march, who determine when the meetings happen, and shut down people they don't want to speak.
I guess the problem of meritocracy being real is who holds the reins of power isn't necessarily the one with the merit.
Well, no. I disagree to a certain extent. I mean, certainly we can argue that a great leader who is very smart and capable would be the one with the true merit, but in terms of wielding power is the person capable of wielding it. So it's kind of like you said, there's a giant rock. Who can lift the giant rock? The person capable of picking it up and carrying it.
Or who gets there first.
Well, no, not really.
Or who deceives all the others about where the rock is.
Well, look. Could you, if you were, if there's a giant rock, you know, let's say, let's the Atlas stone we have. What does that weigh? 160?
You have an Atlas stone. That's awesome.
We do. Yeah. Well, someone brought it for us. If The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, gave you a 10-minute head start, do you think you'd be able to lift the Atlas stone before him?
No.
He'd show up, push you out, step aside, sir, and then he'd pick it up very easily.
There are some people that are built to carry rocks.
There are some people who are brutal.
But is that how leadership works too?
When you look at like Occupy Wall Street,
I guess power isn't necessarily
leadership. There was a power vacuum. There was a bunch of people there. There was a bunch of interest in funding it. And there was a vacuum in who controlled it until someone said, I will. And everyone went, okay. And then that person took it by saying they wanted it.
There's an interesting thing here that whoever takes it, that's sort of the metric that is being tested for. You know, whoever successfully pulls the sword out of the stone,
yeah.
or whoever successfully rises to the front of the crowded Occupy. And the mistake the founders make was thinking that whoever could win elections was the best leader or most appealed to the populace. And in a sense, they're right. It most appealed to the populace, but it's a simple test. There's some rule of thumb, and I forget what it is, but whenever you have a metric that's being tested in a organization or in a industrial process, It works for, you know, a minute, and then pretty soon it gets subverted because people start optimizing for the test and not for the true underlying thing which you were approximating with the test. And I think that's true of democracy.
All right. Atari Kid says slavery in the British Empire ended in 1833, but slavery in England ceased after the Norman Conquest. The Somerset case of 1772 ruled that slavery was so odious that nothing can be suffered to support it but positive law. Interesting.
I've got one piece of tangential thing there, which is I touch on the Norman Conquest in my homesteading books in the context of how deeds work for tractors.
Huh. Interesting.
Huh, interesting.
JR says you can burn plant matter to make potassium chloride. It's a salt substitute. Can also harvest it from animal blood. Oh, really?
Whoa.
Yeah, I guess they got to have salt in them. So I guess you can get salt from deer blood, huh?
True. I make black pudding from pig blood, and it's salty.
Oh, blood pudding. Is that blood pudding?
Yeah, it's good.
I love blood pudding. The first time I had it was in the UK, and you get like a black disc.
Yep.
And then I'm like, what's that? And they're like, blood pudding. And I'm like, cool. I know a lot of people who hate it, but I'm like, food's food, man.
No, it's decent.
Yeah. All right. Seb says, hi from Sweden. First time catching the show live for obvious reasons. Been sub since the van videos. Wow, that was like the first video.
Yeah.
Excellent, man.
Wrong time.
What up, dude?
All right, let's see. Scary Perry says, officially closed on our Florida home today. Here's $10 to celebrate. Cannot wait to be living there. Goodbye, Seattle. Oh, talk about an epic move.
Awesome. Congrats.
From Seattle to Florida. Hey. Now, my only issue with Florida is the weather.
Yes.
But the governance, it's not bad.
And that's my only reason issue with Texas. I'd be there if it weren't for the heat.
Oh, man. Luke keeps trying to get us to go to New Hampshire. Huh.
And
he's
good.
Like, even before we came out here, he was like, New Hampshire is way better. And I was like, dude, I don't want to be in New Hampshire. It's expensive. There's not as much land. It's way more expensive. I'm like, I'll be in the middle of nowhere in the middle of mountains. Plus, like, you know, New Hampshire's surrounded by all these blue areas.
There is that.
Yeah, very, very heavily just every direction. Mm-hmm. But you've got water access.
Yep. So
you got a river.
If the country partitions and New Hampshire is taken over by Massachusetts, then I'll be a refugee.
All right, we got a nice big super chat from TRDSCFJC FJC about not liking Black Rifle Coffee Company.
Oh,
YouTube's not going to allow me to read that super chat. Suffice it to say, they are very upset with Black Rifle Coffee.
As am I,
saying that they don't support patriots who defend themselves against bad child abusers, felons, and domestic abusers. They say, free Kyle, salty army is legion, the salt must flow and re. Yeah, I saw a lot of bad stuff about Black Rifle.
Yeah.
Because they're basically lumping in, like, the majority of the right in with the most extreme elements.
Absolutely. I was tweeting about, even earlier, a month or so ago, I saw that I think their CEO had donated to a pro-gun control politician who said no one needs an AR-15. So, you know, Black Rifle is an interesting marketing scheme, but heck? I'm not sending them my money.
Well, they were able to get a bunch of money from a lot of conservatives, so.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's see. Anime Freak says, you guys mentioned a few videos back text censorship. I work in one of the highest departments you can work in within one of the major carriers, and I can say, if a law was made, we likely wouldn't bat an eye implementing it. Interesting. Well, the intention of the government is very scary. John Clapperton says, no native of India or any natural-born subject of His Majesty shall be disabled from holding any place, office, or employment for any reason, employment by reason of his religion, place of birth, descent of, or color, charter of the East India Company. Interesting. Very interesting. All right, let's see. I see a nice little super chat defending Alex Jones. Okay. All right, let's see what we got. People in, making fun of China. Yep, mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. Lasseri? I've been doing research on helpful weeds. For example, large-leafed plantain draws out venom and can be used as a flower substitute, just to name two uses. It'll leave you speechless, like the book by Michael Knowles that's out now. That one got me. That genuinely got me. Yeah. Normally I'm catching the speechless ones, but that one got me. Yeah, in terms of like wheat flour, right? It's got gluten in it. Is there anything else that you could use that's like comparable?
There are other flours. I know that people use acorn flour. I think that the gluten in wheat flour is hard to replace. And I know that rye, et cetera, just doesn't rise in the same way because you don't get the intermixed gluten.
Yeah. All right, let's see. Will Jones says, Timmy is controlled opposition. Who else can guarantee a business success? Well played, comrade. Well played. We like reading our criticism here at Timcast IRL for sure.
That is silly.
Sandra Nadeau says, sorry, divorce will not work. I'm not moving, nor will I give up my rights. I will stand my ground. Yeah, I hear that. You know, we have conversations about places like Syria where so many people refuse to stay and fight and they fled.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually interviewed two young men who refused to fight and fled.
Neat.
And so, I mean, can you blame them, you know? Be forced to fight for the national army and have your rights ripped away and just be cannon fodder or leave and watch your home country fall apart. Not easy, man. All right. Garhent says, Travis, with you writing for Dragon 117, are you buying the new D&D Strixhaven book? If so, are you excited to get your bestie, Frenemy, and who's your prom date for D&D prom? I am Rolf Lamau at Hasbro. They are so Kathleen Kennedying D&D for wokeness.
Okay.
You play D&D?
I did play back D&D. There's some backstory there, which is I'm a writer, and my first published thing was when I was 13 years old and sent an article into Dragon magazine. And that was published in Dragon issue 117. And about 20 years later, I saw in passing that TSR, which had been bought by Wizards of the Coast, which had been bought by Hasbro, was republishing all of the old articles. And I happened to remember reading my contract from start to finish, and the contract said that I was selling first serial rights, which meant that if they ever wanted to republish it, they had to pay me. So I sent a letter to Hasbro and said, I'm thrilled to hear about this CD-ROM, pay me. And Hasbro never responded to the letter. They republished the CD-ROM, and I sued Hasbro in small claims court for $2,000 because that was the most I could sue for. Mm. And Hasbro didn't show, and I got $2,000. So that's how, as a 13-year-old, I earned $2,100. I just had to wait 20 years to get
creativity
most of it.
Pays.
And with regards to TTRPGs, I live in the middle of nowhere. I try to play occasionally online with some friends. I hope to do more of that. I do buy books. It's fun to just see what's going on. And the crazy insanity SJW stuff in D&D, there's a new... there was some wheelchair thing, because when people do escapism, what they really want to think about is being disabled. And then the new thing that was announced a day or so ago was some sort of new woke Harry Potter bisexual elves in college campaign setting for D&D. Hmm. And I'm just going to quote the meme of the Chinese guy. It's also tiresome.
Yes.
Wow. All right. Scott McInthan says, insurance sales is necessary. Insuring your home and auto is easy. Mostly can be done through a computer and automated process. Large, complex commercial industries requiring insurance need a human to underwrite and risk assess. 100% agree. And I accept that with the, and I will issue the correction. What I meant to say is there are a lot of people that used to just do like auto. You'd walk in and be like, I want to do auto. And there are still places that do this.
Yeah, there's storefronts and a guy sitting behind a desk waiting for you.
Yeah. And to me, I see that. I'm like, that's crazy. Yeah, of course, I think they're mostly going away.
Yeah.
But like, you know, there's still video stores. Actually, they need them in places with bad internet. Yeah, video stores still exist.
I hear that car salesmen are on their way out. And that, cool. You know, Tesla will send the car to your house directly. Like, mm-hmm. You go online, yep. You order it online. And
a lot of companies will do that.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that is basically just rent-seeking. Like, maybe at some point it started out, but rent-seeking is an economic term, and not rent as a reasonable thing where you're trading money for use of land, but rent where someone just interjects themselves in a transaction and peels their slice off the top, and there's no way to get around it.
Like a banker.
All right. Tim Decker says March 9th for the win. Why? That's my birthday. Is it your birthday? 16-year 3M mile trucker here. The left has made trucking into cities a loss leader with fuel costs and regulations. Drivers already refuse loads to the coasts. Consider that. Yeah, man. You know what I think's happening?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were at an ice cream stand the other day, and there was a huge line, and everyone's buying ice cream. And I thought to myself, how many of these people got jobs? You know, because a lot of people are getting unemployment. So what does that mean? They're being given money, mm-hmm. and then they're extracting resources from the system without replacing it. Basically, it's kind of like, I was thinking, we have a slushy machine downstairs, you know, and when it's full of slushy, but you got to keep putting slushy in. Mm-hmm. Eventually, the slushy runs out.
Well, they're printing slushy. That's
what happens?
The problem.
No, they're not. They're not. What they're printing is access to pull the slushy lever.
Mm.
And when you do, when we go to clean the slushy machine, we have to empty it. So we hold the thing open and drain what's left of the slushy and let it all pour out, and that's what feels like is happening.
Mm.
It's they're emptying thing. The Great Reset.
Mm-hmm.
The economy and everything is being stripped of resources very slowly, and then eventually it gets reset filled with hot water and cleaning solution and scrubbed out, and then something else is put inside?
You know, I'm going to go with inflation, or at least argue for it a bit. And one interesting thing is I wrote the first draft of this book about 3 years ago, and I've been working on it very slowly. And then with COVID, I thought, now's the time. Let me, you know, turbo through it and get it done. And so I ended up going through the parts that I'd already written. I ended up checking prices where I said, you know, this rototiller to mount on your tractor is $2,000. And I went back to Tractor Supply, and it's $2,500. And, you know, this chicken fencing is $12. And I, you know, go to Lowe's.com, and it's $19. There has been a lot of inflation going on.
Oh, man.
And I used to laugh at these nut job conspiracists who were saying there's stealth inflation. It's not showing up in the figures. But, you know, I don't know, man. I stumbled into it myself. I think it's real.
All right, let's do. Let's get a couple more in, as many as we can. All right, let's see. Lone Star Carper says, Tim, I gave you a super chat, maybe your first, when you played a Trump video game on this channel. Great guest tonight. Love and enjoy the show nightly. Oh, there was a fighting game that was made in the. I wonder if that would get you banned at this point. It was a fighting game where it was called like Andrew Yang for President or something, and it was actually really fun. And really, I was surprised at how offensive it was because Elizabeth Warren was wearing Native American gear and she would make stereotypical, like, an offensive, you know,
sounds
and stuff. Mm-hmm. And her super move was to, like, summon a giant bull or something. And so it was really just like, but I guess it was making fun of her for being racist. So it's okay, whatever. And then, you know, Donald Trump throws money as his special move or whatever. It was actually a really fun
awesome.
Game. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Oh, where are we at? Chelsea Nelson says, my husband is a composer arranger and is interested in working with you. He's emailed you a few times at jobs@timcast.com, DerekNelson.com. Thanks. I will take a look. We may have someone, though. We may. We'll see. Jack of Blades says, play D&D with me, you cowards. What's a good way to get in touch with you for your podcast so I can introduce you to the woke psychic brain rat collective imprisoned by vice a la Planescape? I suppose pitches@timcast.com. Yeah, so one of the shows we're going to do is a weekly D&D
awesome.
Series, and we want to do a campaign that's based around like modern political ideas, but implemented
cool.
through D&D.
Very cool.
And then just see how people play and how they try and resolve some of these situations.
I was playing a bunch of Neverwinter Nights today to get refamiliarized with 3.5.
Mm-hmm.
3.5?
Yeah, the rule set. D&D 3.5.
One writing project I want to do someday is write a RPG based on the Aristillus science fiction novels. So I've got infinite writing projects for the next 10 or 20 years.
What's the Aristillus?
The science fiction novels that I wrote that I was talking about earlier.
Oh,
so.
Yeah, dude.
Oh, what's this? Firepower Fantasy says, hey, Tim, I mainly wanted a super chat to support your content, but I also have to ask, do any of y'all have some recommended reading? You know, I would recommend you check out Escape the City.
Oh.
And volumes 1 and 2.
I was going to say, we should
cover.
Recommend these.
Yeah, Travis, it's literally his books. Actually, I'm really excited that you have these. You're going to give us those books, right?
Absolutely,
epic, dude.
Because we definitely need them.
Tim, I will not only give you a set of these books, I will give you a set of wool socks from my sheep.
That's
Let me
cool.
see this.
These are literally from your sheep?
Yeah.
Like you sheared it and knitted the wool?
Literally.
This is incredible.
I outsourced the knitting.
Oh, you outsourced the knitting.
Yeah.
You ever see that video of the, what do they call him, Shrek? The sheep that, like,
Yeah.
And it was just a massive mass, like, wow, they survive?
Mm-hmm.
But you have to shear them, right? Otherwise they go.
So most sheep, yes. We have a more primitive breed of sheep. And actually, there's pictures of them. These are Icelandic sheep.
Awesome.
So, you know, these pictures are from my farm. I forget the name of this sheep. And, you know, again, this is, you know, 200 feet from my house in one of the pastures where I keep sheep.
Beautiful.
I don't even understand, like, looking at this, like, how did this come from a sheep?
right.
But I know it's where it comes from.
Yeah. You know, it starts with my wife opening a stall door in the barn and me wrestling the sheep out. And it ends up at a year and a half later. And I'm wearing a set of wool socks myself, which
you
is
gotta, like, grab their legs. Like, I watch videos of people shearing sheep, and it's pretty intense. Like,
tie your legs up, or you don't have to tie them up.
Okay.
You know, there's this wrestling thing that if somebody's feet are off the ground, there's not much they can do. So you flip the sheep onto its butt, and yeah, that's how we do the shearing. And they also get a bunch of vitamins injected, sort of, you know, vitamin paste behind their teeth, and they swallow it and they get a shot. Hmm. And there's a process we go through a couple times a year.
I saw that thing where there was like baby sheep on a conveyor belt. You ever see that? They're like sitting in a slide.
I did not.
Oh, it was like they were giving shots, like vaccinations.
Oh, neat.
And so it's like they're all just just sitting there with their feet up and they slide forward and they fall in a thing and then get dropped to the ground and they run away?
Things were a bit more earthy on our farm. I have a couple of times pulled a baby lamb out of its mother.
Whoa. And that's exciting.
Once when there was a breech birth, I loaded a pregnant ewe with a lamb half coming out of her into the car, because we don't have a truck right now, drove her the next town over to a vet. So, wow. Yeah, we need a conveyor belt. That sounds better.
Exciting. In terms of books, though, shout out to Michael Malice's book, The Anarchist Handbook, and Michael Malice's Speechless, which they're always tricking
Michael
me
into. Michael Knowles.
Michael Knowles.
Yeah, the other Michael.
Michael Malice's Anarchist Handbook and Michael Knowles. Too many Michaels.
Too many Michaels.
And what are the
Carol
books?
Carol Roth's Posobiec. The War on Small Business looks incredible. Yes. I still haven't read that, but The War on Small Business.
And Jack Posobiec's The Antifa.
Antifa, yeah.
Oh, Antifa book.
Behind the Black Block, yeah.
.com.
Yeah, yeah. Andy Knows Unmasked. Mm-hmm. And is anybody else we need to shout out?
I still haven't read The Creature from Jekyll Island. I hear it's phenomenal if you're interested in the history of the Federal Reserve.
Neat. Oh, cool. All right. We'll do a couple more here. We got Taylor Ludke says, third generation almond grower. Tim, take it easy on the almonds are terrible for the environment tweets. Almond prices don't need to be beaten down anymore. Going to have to cancel my Timcast membership if this keeps up. I don't think I tweeted that. I think I said that almonds consume tons of water. And so the risk is when California's in a big drought or if there's economic problems, almonds are on the chopping block. Which is said, I love almonds.
Okay? Especially
I like almonds. I like Kind bars. I got almonds all up in them.
Oh, so good.
All right, here we go. Deus Flex says, to provide context for Kyle Kashev, adult actress Brandy Love was kicked out of a TPUSA event by social conservatives. Kyle not only approved, but went on to disavow libertarians and called small government a fantasy. Yes, this is hilarious that there's actually a battle happening over this. And maybe we'll get into this in the bonus segment. I don't know if we need to, but I am much more libertarian. I think the conservatives are losing tons of allies over this. I certainly understand what the conservatives are saying. I think adult films, generally bad for people, the way it's kind of gone out of control. But at the same time, small government, man, you let people live and let live, and you got to build that coalition and support people when, like, find out where you agree with people, and you need those allies in the great battle.
Yeah, Chrissy Mayer just did a podcast, I believe, with Brandy Love today.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't already, give that like button a smash, subscribe to this channel, share it with your friends. You can follow us at TimcastIRL on Facebook and Instagram, at Timcast_IRL on TikTok. Help share our videos and like them so we can leverage those networks. Get more people to go to Timcast.com and become members, which is the website is growing. It's taken off. We got some bugs, so apologies for that. But go to Timcast.com, become a member for that members only podcast. New shows on the horizon. You guys got to check out Shane Cashman's articles. Because he's writing about, mysteries and stuff. But these are legit, like, investigations into real-world phenomena. We're not talking about, like, some story where a guy claims he went and, you know, his apple pie was actually an alien or something. Like, he writes a story about what's happening with these birds that are going missing. And so there's a bunch of stories about crows falling from the sky. These are legitimate stories. And then he's, you know, asking the experts, talking to government officials to figure out what's going on. And he did one that was really great, investigating a death. And in West Point that he knew about, and it looks like it might be a cover-up. So it's fun stuff. It's fun stuff. It is more like spooky story-esque, but it is real stuff. It's not fiction. It's not speculative. I am no fan of people being like, I swear there was a ghost and I'll prove it. And they're like, I care about people who are skeptical but interested in those mysteries. So check that stuff out. There's a new show coming on that soon. We're going to be working on it in the next couple of weeks to have a full podcast. And you can follow me personally at TimCast. Now, we just shouted out a bunch of your books, but you want to mention your sci-fi books as well.
So my first
and your social media too, yeah.
Great. First science fiction novel was The Powers of the Earth, and it won the Prometheus Award in 2018 for Best Libertarian Science Fiction Novel. My second novel was Causes of Separation, the sequel to the first one, and it also won the Prometheus Award the next year, and I think this is the first time that an author won it 2 years in a row, and I think it's the first time that maybe self-published books won it. And this is a saga set about 50 years from now about small government people and really kind of a great divorce thing that we've been talking about this whole time. There's this concept of loyalty, voice, or exit, where you disagree with someone, you either act loyal to them and swallow your objections, or you speak up in sort of a democratic way, or you just leave. My personal preference is just leaving. So this is a novel about that. It involves lunar colonization. It involves artificial intelligence, anti-gravity, genetically uplifted dogs, and it's all fairly hard science fiction. It's not, the Force and lightsabers and stuff.
Fantasy stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, they've got something on the order of 500, 4.5 or 5-star reviews, so it's decent stuff. And if you like science fiction, please
give
it a shot.
They're
big, too. Yeah, I don't write small books. I like big books, and I cannot lie.
If for some reason HBO, you know, licenses for a TV show, just make sure you finish the books before.
Right. I think my opinions are such that I would never have a major media deal. I think TimCast is where I belong.
Maybe we'll have to do it. Well, yeah. You know, I was thinking of doing is taking a room and making the entire room a green screen,
mm-hmm.
because then you can make movies about anything.
Mm-hmm. Or project green light on the walls all around, because then I think
that's
you could do
harder.
That too.
We can just paint a room green and put lights on.
I'm so into this.
Ian, you have a website or
I
something.
I do. It's iancrossland.net, and I'm at Ian Crossland. Travis, thanks for coming, man. I love talking
thanks
about
for having me.
The
this is
systemic
a great time.
Transfer or alterations that are potential.
Yeah, and PV equals NRT. We'll talk about that
more
afterwards.
We're talking about inflation and free energy.
Yeah.
That's right. Sounds good. And you guys are more than welcome to follow me on Twitter at Sour Patch Lids.
We will see you all over at TimCast.com in the Members Podcast coming up around 11 or so p.m. Thanks for hanging out. We'll see you then.
Bye.